Members, we don't have quorum yet, but we're going to get started by listening intently to Representative Murphy's bill, House File 153, and we will move it officially when we do get quorum. Representative Murphy, welcome to the Property Tax Committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And with me is John Mulder from the Hermantown City of, from the City of Hermantown. And House File 153 is a bill that was in 848 in May, and that passed the House of Representatives. But there is an amendment, one, to put it in the same language as the 848 language is. And it changes the date from 2026 to 2036 for the extension of the sales tax that the voters voted on in the November election, 76%.
So, Representative Murphy, we do have quorum now. If you'll wait with me for just a moment here. Call this meeting of the House Property Tax and Local Finance Division to order. We'll begin with the approval of the minutes from March 13th. Representative Barr moves the March 13th minutes. Any discussion on the minutes? Additions, corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes as presented from March 13th, 2017, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are adopted. And with that, Representative Markwart moves that the committee entertain House File 153 and that it be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Markwart also moves that the A2 amendment to House File 153 be adopted. Members, discussion on the A2 amendment. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The A2 is adopted. Representative Murphy, thank you for your initial presentation, and you want to go now with your testifier, correct?
Correct.
Okay, welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. My name is John Mulder. I'm the city administrator for the city of Hermantown. As Representative Murphy stated, this was in the bill last year that was passed by the legislature, and we went to the voter approval, went to the voter in the November election, and the voters approved it by 76%. The voters were very supportive of this project. This is not an expansion of the sales tax, but just an additional use for the sales tax. So the voters were very supportive of that project, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Mulder. Any other testifiers on House File 153? And again, this is a wellness center, Representative Murphy.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I remember the discussion last time. Questions, members? Representative Markwart.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And unlike the Hermantown hockey team, your testimony did not go into overtime to get this passed.
Thank goodness for that.
And so this wellness center, is that going to help out with more of this dynasty in the hockey for Hermantown?
Yeah.
Representative Murphy? Because that may determine my vote.
Representative Markwart, I think she just wants the puck in the goal.
And for it to count.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, the Wellness Center is a regional wellness center, but Hermantown is the site for it because they have donated the land, the Hermantown School District has donated the land to place the Wellness Center on. But it includes also 14 townships that surround in South St. Louis County. And South St. Louis County is the 76th most unwell county in the state. And that is not right. There's no reason why the rating for St. Louis County sticks in the bottom 15 of the most diseases, most smoking, most drinking, most everything. And we have to address that growing problem with diabetes and with lung cancer and other kinds of cancers that continually plague the people of South St. Louis County and North St. Louis County.
Thank you. Representative Markwart? Any more? Okay.
Yep.
Members, other questions, comments? Thank you. Final comments, Representative Murphy?
I appreciate your support.
Thank you. With that, the chair lays over. Actually, Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 153, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion, and the file is laid over. House File 154, Representative Loeffler moves that House File 154 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Murphy, House File 154.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 154 was in House File 848, the tax bill that passed last spring also. And Proctor's asking for an additional half cent on their sales tax so they can be just like Duluth and Hermantown in the abundance that they receive. Jake Benson, the city councilor from Proctor, is with me and can testify.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Mr. Benson, welcome, and please introduce yourself and proceed, sir.
Jake Benson, I'm a city councilor in the city of Proctor, and Representative Brokowski, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to provide some testimony on House File 154. Proctor is bordered on three sides by Duluth and Hermantown that both have a 1% sales tax. All we're looking for is some equity. When our residents go into both Hermantown and Duluth, they spend the 1%, and Proctor it's a 0.5%. When our citizens first enacted the 0.5% sales tax back in 1991, it passed by a 91% margin. Back in 2014, when we sought to extend it to a full 1%, it passed by a 78% margin. So with that, we're just asking for fairness and equity.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Benson. Members, anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Members, questions for Representative Murphy? Okay, hearing none. Representative Murphy, any final thoughts?
I appreciate your support.
Succinct is good. Thank you. With that, House File, Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 154 be laid over for possible inclusion, and that House File is laid over. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Mr. Benson. House File 172, Representative Lean. Representative Lean moves that his bill, House File 172, be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. House File 172 is a local option sales tax and bonding authority bill for a new jail and law enforcement center in Clay County. The tax would be a 0.5 cent sales tax for 20 years or until sufficient funding for the project has been generated. The cost of the new jail and law enforcement center will be $52 million. In addition to the sales tax, Clay County will be financing bonds with levy dollars, wind energy taxes, and lease payments by the City of Moorhead for space use in the Law Enforcement Center. The sales tax was approved by voters at the last general election by a vote of 66% to 34%. The sales tax was also supported by the Moorhead Business Association, an organization of area businesses. The tax may expire sooner than 30 years by county ordinance. Mr. Chair and members, I will now introduce Clay County Commissioner Grant Whalen to discuss more about the county's current jail and law enforcement center and what this project does present.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Mr. Whalen, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division Committee. My name is Grant Whalen. I'm a Clay County Commissioner, and also with me today are Commissioner Kevin Campbell and our County Administrator Brian Berg. We are here today to ask for your support on a very important matter to the citizens of Clay County, approval of a local sales tax to help pay for construction of our new jail and law enforcement center. Clay County is the county seat, Clay County's county seat is the city of Moorhead and lies adjacent to Fargo, North Dakota. We currently have the oldest jail facility in the state of Minnesota, constructed in 1966. We do not meet the 2911 rules promulgated by the Department of Corrections and have worked vigorously with the DOC to continue the use of our facility. We are currently under an exemption as we have made improvements and promised construction of a new facility. We continuously board 40 to 60 prisoners per day in other counties. Most are being transported to Crookston, Minnesota, or Douglas County, Minnesota, which is 75 to 100 miles away for us. We are a small taxing entity and saddled with big city problems. The Morehead Fargo metropolitan area is in excess of 230 to 40,000 population and thus carries with it bigger city problems, such as criminal activity most commonly seen in areas of larger populations. We are the gateway to the oil field activities of North Dakota and are feeling the negative effects of the oil boom. Our correctional facility is continuously seeing charges of drug activity as illegal drugs are funneled to the western part of North Dakota. Mental health issues are a major concern and a problem for our prisoners, yet we do not have the ability in our jail to meet the needs of our prisoners or the providers of services to them. We are a farming community with big city liabilities, and our farmland is currently being taxed beyond capacity. According to the state auditor's data site, Clay County was ranked 79th out of 87 counties in our taxing capacity in 2012. Unfortunately, our citizens cannot afford to build a new jail. Clay County has begun to prepare jail construction. We have started to increase our levy slightly by $50,000 a year to help make future bond payments. Our county board has obligated 75% of maturing bond payments towards future jail bond payments, and the county receives a small amount of wind energy tax revenue, $150,000 a year, and 80% of that has been obligated. However, these dollars will fall far short. With the support of the Morehead Business Association, the Chamber of Commerce, the Clay County Sheriff's Association, the Morehead Police Department Association, and endorsed unanimously by Clay County Commission, the citizens passed a referendum on November 8th with 66% of the vote wishing to enact a half-cent sales tax to help pay for our new facilities. So we are here today asking for your support and passage of House File 172 for the purpose of imposing a local sales tax of 1/2 cent to help pay for these facilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wayland. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Questions, members? Representative Markler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lean, for bringing this forward. Commissioner Wayland, for your testimony. The Fargo-Moorhead-Clay County area is literally an area of about 250,000 people, about 250,000 people. And when we talk about regional nature of projects, this is truly a regional jail because you have the North Dakota side right with Moorhead. You're getting these prisoners who are in there are from kind of all over. But one other unique thing about this project is they're going to have a behavioral health unit in this to deal with the mental health issues that are so important. So hopefully it's not just putting these prisoners in and sending them back out, but hoping they don't come back again. So it really is an excellent project. And, you know, the decision that the county board was talking to folks about last fall was, you know, how do you want to pay for this, property taxes or a sales tax? And, you know, it was 2-to-1 to go with the sales tax. So I know we don't have a lot of correctional facilities that come before us for a local option sales tax, but this truly is regional and is going to be unique in how they're going to deal with the mental health issues. So just my strong support for that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Markler. Others, questions, members? Hearing none, Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just quickly want to correct. I misspoke that the tax may expire sooner than 20 years by county ordinance, not 30 years. So just to clarify that. But, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you hearing the bill and members. I hope I can count on your support for the project. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lean. With that, Representative Lean does renew his motion that House File 172 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
House File 191, Representative Sundin. Representative Lunan moves that House File 191 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. It was a late night last night. We were actually in this room until 10:45 over in that chair there. I just remind Representative Paul, that I understand that you can go home once in a while. He's sitting in the same chair he was at 10:45 last night. I have the honor of having the city of Moose Lake in my district. It's going through a transformation now. As part of that, at one point, bringing forth a bill to help the community build a new school. It's been rebuilt a couple of times, a couple of different floods, and there's still work to do. And the city of Moose Lake is ready to do it on their own. I'm looking for some bonding authority through 191 and a sales tax, half-cent sales tax, that has already been approved by the population of Moose Lake. And I have with me today City Administrator Tim Peterson to speak on the details of the bill and give us a rundown of what the city of Moose Lake is up to.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tim Peterson. I'm the city administrator for Moose Lake. And we would like to thank you for hearing our request for a 1.5% local option sales tax. The city of Moose Lake is requesting this use for parks and trails, our regional Riverside Arena, as well as infrastructure and road projects. To address kind of each area, I'll start with the regional impact of our arena, which not only serves Moose Lake, but the surrounding areas from just south of Cloquet down to Hinckley, west to Cromwell and McGregor, and east to the borders of Wisconsin. Our summer includes locally grown farmers markets and concerts, and the hockey function of this building supports children and schools across a massive geographical area, including Barnum, Willow River, Sturgeon Lake, Rutledge, Sandstone, Kettle River, Cromwell, McGregor, etc. The entire region depends on this arena to serve so many important functions for our community. Infrastructure is not a topic that, or is a topic that is at the forefront for so many communities throughout the state, with each and every community wondering how they are going to pay for the rising needs that continue to grow and get more costly each year. The city of Moose Lake is requesting to be self-sufficient in this aspect, to no longer request state aid, to no longer seek the free money that so many vie for. We are simply asking to utilize our own community to invest in the roads and infrastructure needs that we have. Our community is more than 70% tax exempt, with the state of Minnesota owning the vast majority of the exempt land. We are grateful for the jobs that the two state facilities have created, but unfortunately this puts the tax burden on about 30% of the property within Moose Lake. If even half of the value that was tax exempt could be taxed, it would more than double our budget. I know that the argument has been made before, and Moose Lake has been told that our community is too small or that this type of tax is not something that is likely to pass. But with special circumstances like ours, we can need to continue to ask and try to be as self-sufficient as we can be. Our community residents were asked at a recent election this very question, and over two-thirds of them said yes to requesting a sales tax. Our Moose Lake Area Chamber once again reconfirmed their support through a unanimous passing of a resolution of support of a citywide sales tax. Our community simply wants to look within to pay for the increasing needs that we have. Everyone knows something needs to change with how our communities fund infrastructure needs. This is us requesting the state to allow us to help ourselves. Looking at nearby communities of Cloquet, Proctor, Hermantown, Duluth, who all have sales taxes, and yet consumers are still wanting to shop in these communities, we simply want to utilize the means that we have, similar to other local communities, to fund our projects. I'd like to once again thank you for the opportunity to speak here today, and on behalf of our community residents, business owners, government officials, I ask that you please consider and approve the City of Moose Lake to have a 1.5% sales tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Anyone else who would like to testify? Questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the testimony, and good luck with your work up there. It's a pretty country, and I support the bill.
Thank you.
Other questions? One question I have, Mr. Peterson. In the bill, it also includes additional bonding authority that would not be included in your bonding limits, according to statute. Can you tell us about the city's ability to repay those bonds?
The city's ability to repay the bonds is is fine. The sales tax helps allow us to fund some of these projects without having to use the tax base that we currently have. All of the whether it be road improvement, utility improvements, Riverside Arena improvements that could be made, we can make them. The sales tax allows us to use other avenues rather than continuing to tax the 30% base that we currently use.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Hearing none, Representative Sundin, any final comments?
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Before dropping this bill, I actually approached one of the major retailers in the city of Moose Lake and checked in with them, and they said, no, this is a good thing for the city. They run an implement business in snowmobile sales, American-made, Minnesota-made snowmobiles, and they were in favor of this. So business community's on. Everybody's on board. I hope this committee is as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. Representative Lunan renews his motion on House File 191 be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, the House File is laid over. Thank you both. House File 446 is next. Representative Bennett. Welcome. Representative New moves that House File 446 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for hearing this bill. Mr. Chair and members, in 2005, the Minnesota Legislature approved the 5% sales option sales tax for the city of Albert Lea. The proceeds of that tax are used for lake improvement projects, as detailed in the Shell Rock River Watershed Plan that you should have in your packets there. The duration of the tax was 10 years after the tax was first imposed, or the amount would meet or exceed the $15 million. The sales tax went into effect on April 1, 2006, and it was set to expire under the first condition in March 2016. In 2014, the legislature extended it for 5 years, and from what I understand, that was because the economy wasn't quite where we needed it to be to pull in the entire $15 million. So this new sales tax now is set to expire in 2017 because it has reached the $15 million threshold. This bill would extend the Albert Lea 5% local option sales tax for another 15 years or $15 million, whichever comes first. Albert Lea, if you've ever been down there, and if you haven't, I welcome you there, is a beautiful city, and it's the gateway to Minnesota. And as you drive on 35 going coming from Iowa going north, one of the first things you see, you go over a bridge and you see our beautiful Albert Lea Lake. So our lakes are that gateway. They're an economic driver for our communities, and also employment, recruitment, and retention is part of that as well. Our community through the Shell Rock River Watershed District is in the midst of a watershed transformation. We've achieved a lot in the last decade, but there's more to be done. The extension is needed to continue with our water quality improvements to the lakes and streams within the Shell Rock River watershed. That includes Fountain Lake in Albert Lea and Albert Lea Lake. I'm pleased to say this proposal has strong support from the community. And here with me to present additional testimony is Laura Cunningham, president of the Lakes Foundation, and Chad Adams, our city manager.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, my name is Laura Cunningham, and I am the president of the Albert Lea Lakes Foundation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I do want to call your attention to our fact sheet, which is included in your packet. That has a lot of the information that Representative Bennett already shared with you. And our local option sales tax, like Representative Bennett said, is used to implement water quality projects contained within the Shell Rock River Watershed District Management Plan. And that plan is required under 103D and is reviewed by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. An updated 10-year plan was actually just approved in 2016. And our Shell Rock River Watershed District has a proven track record of water quality projects and leveraging outside funding for the benefit of our community and our waters. We have generated $5.9 million in local sales tax that has been able to leverage $4.6 million in outside funding, which is a 78% match. We have significantly improved our fishery habitat and our water quality in area lakes, assisting with flood protection projects as well as enhancing recreational opportunities. Moving ahead with significant multi-year projects to clean up and restore our lakes for fishing, habitat, recreation, and water quality. This has been just a significant change and improvement in our watershed. We are seeking this extension because there is more to do in cleaning up our lakes and restoring our water quality. We've been focused on the upland streams and lakes, and now it's time to work at restoring the water quality that affect the lakes in the heart of our community. As Representative Bennett mentioned, we are the gateway to Minnesota. One of our lakes literally runs underneath Interstate 35, so it's a pretty nice welcome to the state. We have been basically focused on those outer watershed projects, but now we have Fountain Lake and Albert Lee Lake that are the last two lakes that flow out of our watershed. So it's pretty important and critical that we keep going. The tax generates approximately $1.2 million a year. Representative Bennett did mention that we had a couple of years where it did not meet that target, but this is where we're at annually right now. This is collected by our city and transferred to the watershed district. We are now requesting $15 million or over 15 years because that matches our experience with our first local option sales tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Mr. Adams?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chad Adams, City Manager for the City of Albert Lea. I'm here this morning to share with you that this proposal has overwhelming support from our city and from our community. You can see a list of these supporters on the bottom of the fact sheet, as well as the letters of support in your packets. Our old city council from 2016, our members, and our new city council from 2017 have passed unanimous resolutions of support of this extension of the sales tax. In November 2016, more importantly, the citizens of Albert Lea expressed overwhelming 72% support to continue the sales tax. We appreciate your time this morning and would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Questions, members? Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who could answer this question, so I'll just direct it to you folks. Does this project qualify at all under the legacy funds?
Ms. Cunningham?
Yes, we have a pretty extensive history with projects that have qualified for legacy funding. Directly with the watershed district, so they have had a lot of success. In fact, the numbers I mentioned about leveraging those outside funds, much of that is in partnership with Legacy. So,
Representative Barr.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay. With that, thank you all. Representative Bennett, final word.
Well, thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for hearing our bill. I hope it gets approval because we want to keep working on our water quality.
Thank you so much. With that, Representative Newery moves our motion House File 446 be laid over for possible inclusion. The House File is laid over. Have a safe trip back, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you. House File 1325, Representative Metza. And members, I see other members here. Representative Metza has got a constituent from 5 hours away, so we're gonna bring him in and let that constituent get back and keep our economy humming along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metzler, we'll move the bill first. Welcome. Representative Frankie moves that House File 1325 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Metzler.
Thank you, Representative Frankie, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Today we're here discussing a fund that essentially distributes local property taxes from the that's run through the IRRRB, and the specific account is the municipal account that we've made some changes on, And all we're doing is essentially freezing that account at the 1983 levels. And if tied to inflation, currently that'd be roughly $6 million in that account would go up to about 16. And this would provide all the communities up north when, you know, a committee like this passes an LGA increase and we put it on the floor and our communities take a hit during the mining turndown. Essentially, it's locked in at 42 million tons of production, which then if we don't meet that criterion for production that year, these communities would receive a 2% decrease for every million tons that's not there. So what we're looking to do is stabilize and provide a little bit more local control with these communities by allowing them to get a little bit more fair shake at what we see as a law that needed adjusting since it hadn't been really looked at since 1983 and adjusted. And with that, I'll turn it over to Paul Kess, my testifier, who came many miles this morning. So thank you for squeezing us in.
Thank you, Representative Metz, and thank you for coming down. Mr. Kess, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Excuse me just a second here. First, I want to thank you for moving me up on the agenda. I have a long trip home with a van full of grandchildren, so the sooner I can move, the more fun we'll have when we get north. I'm a city councilor in the city of Ely, but in my role here today in front of you, I'm the president of the RAMS Association of Municipalities and Schools. RAMS represents 150 townships, 50 cities, 12 school districts. Population is in excess of 72,000 people. We strive to, rather than have all of those people in front of you trying to testify, to bring to you the model of one range, one voice. And so we've considered the legislation, House File 1325, are in support of this, and I'm here to ask you to act favorably on that. It does, as Representative Metza has suggested, stabilizes funding for our communities as we look forward to plan and implement our community budgets over time. For my own city, City of Ely, it would represent an increase of about, I think, $44,000. So it's not a huge change. But for a formula that hasn't changed since 1983, and that's before my children were born, and probably most of yours. And so it seems like there needs to be a tweak now and then to make this more realistic. And so that's what we're asking you to do. It also indexes the fund to inflation. I think this is the only fund that is not indexed to inflation. There's no general fund dollars involved. It would result in a reduction in some $600,000 to both the Environmental Fund and the Douglas Johnson Fund. So it's not a huge impact within the distribution, but it brings the distribution of taconite municipal aid to a more realistic and a stable level. So with that in mind, you know, as I was considering my testimony this morning, and we've worked through this before, it didn't seem like rocket science to me. It just seems like something that we need to do to sort of bring this up to speed. So I'd ask that you look on the bill favorably. And I do want to thank Representative Metza for bringing this forward. As the evolving nature of taconite taxes and the distribution within the taconite tax area evolves over time, these kinds of things I think will come forward. This seems like an easy one, and I appreciate your support. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kess. Anyone else would like to testify on the bill? Questions, members? For Mr. Kess or Representative Metza? Hearing none, Representative Frankie or Representative Metza, any final short words?
I guess I would just say thank you for, again, moving us up. Thanks for your consideration. And that one added side note, I know we've had bills in the past that can get partisan when we deal with the agency. This one, just so everyone knows, treats all the communities the same, so there's no winners or losers in the district. The formula goes out evenly across the entire relief area.
That wouldn't be real typical for the Iron Range, Representative Metza.
Mr. Chair, we're growing.
Okay, thank you. With that, Representative Frankie renews his motion that House File 1325 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Baker, House File 536. Representative Rarick moves that House File 536 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Baker.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you very much. Both two small requests here this morning with our local option sales tax votes. Both my mayors from City of Spicer and the City of New London could not be here this morning. But again, I bring forward to Mr. Chair favorable vote that happened in November to raise a half a percent sales tax for the beautiful little city of New London. It's a city on the pond, about 1,200 members in their community, and they have a vibrant art community and a vibrant retail community downtown, and I am very proud to present this bill to the committee to possibly be included in future bills. So I should tell you what we're going to use the money for. This vote allows the City of New London to impose a local option sales tax to be used for the construction and equipping a new library and community room, construction of an ambulance bay, and also improvements to the Senior Citizen Center. About $872,000 is what the plan is, and the tax will be done in 20 years. So very good bill, very supportive in the community, and I would wholeheartedly support this as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Anyone like to testify for or against the bill? Questions, members? Hearing none, Representative Baker, I think you're going to have the fastest bill of the day.
Appreciate the support.
Okay, thank you. With that, we'll move this bill. Representative Rarick moved this bill. Representative Rarick renews his motion on the House File 536 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Baker. And Representative Baker, House File 537, right behind it. With that, Representative Anderson moves that House File 537 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, the sister city to New London is Spicer. They actually share a school district, New London Spicer. The Wildcats, in fact, they're down here for the girls' basketball tournament as well. They again approved a first time ever local option sales tax in the community last fall. They would like to use the money in the beautiful city that's on Green Lake for some pedestrian public safety improvements that will cross Highway 23. Park and trail capital improvements, as well as capital improvements to regional community facilities. They're actually looking at possibly an overpass over the busy Highway 23 that will connect the one side of the city to the other. So with that also, Mr. Chair, I am very proud to support this today. Mayor Denny Baker, no relation, could not be here this morning as well, and City Administrator Leslie Vallant would love to be here, but because of timing, couldn't be here this morning. So with that, I appreciate your support.
Thank you. Anyone like to testify on House File 537 at this time? Questions, members? Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson renews his motion. House File 537 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Baker.
Thank you so much.
Representative Nornes, House File 554.
Morning.
Welcome, Representative Nornes. Representative Lean moves that House File 554 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Nornes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This bill has to deal with a half-cent sales tax request for the city of Fergus Falls. And to explain it further, I have the mayor of Fergus Falls, Ben Shire, and for backup, we have city administrator, we have Andrew Frenseth, and the librarian for Fergus Falls, Aaron Smith. So the mayor, I should say, was up at 3 o'clock this morning to be here on time, so I'll release my time to him. So.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. And Mayor, welcome. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This project...
Mr. Mayor, if you could introduce yourself quick and then...
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Shire, Mayor of the City of Fergus Falls. The project before your House File 554 is a project that would allow us to impose a local option sales tax to fund the Fergus Falls Public Library Expansion Renewal Project. It's a project that started in February of 2012 and included more than 4 years of community input in the city of Fergus Falls and the surrounding communities in the region. That 4 years culminated in a vote of 66% of our voters in the 2016 November 8th election. I'd also add that in addition to the local option sales tax, there's a private fundraising campaign. Currently, there's $2.5 million raised with a goal of $3 million to supplement the project in addition to the local option sales tax. And I would also add that 75% of the business community through a Chamber of Commerce survey supported the project. And again, it is a regional project in the sense that Fergus Falls is a regional center. And there's a number of small communities surrounding Fergus Falls that do not have public libraries. So I would thank you for your time and ask for your support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Anyone else would like to testify on the bill? Questions, members? Representative Nornison, Mayor
Shire.
Thank you. I had a chance to visit with Mayor Shire and the other delegation from the Fergus Falls community, and I can tell you, members, there's a great deal of support for this project. It was very much impressed upon me at that meeting. And I really appreciate the way you have the bill structured for the earlier of 12 years or when sufficient funds to pay off the bonds. Conservative work. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add one thing. The delegation that was here to kind of lobby on behalf of this project included a couple of Ben Shire's children. So that was really the key, I think, to at least five of them were here, which is something we don't see every day. So
future hunters and fishermen.
That's right.
Yes. Questions, members? I think we've got. I think we're good to go. With that, Representative Lean renews his motion that House File 554 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mayor Shire and President Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson has two bills. First one of members will be House File 659.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Chair Torkelson. Representative Frankie moves that House File 659 be entertained by the committee and lay over for possible inclusion. Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 659 and deals with the City of New Ulm. They would like to renew their sales tax, and they have that was first passed in 1999 with a vote of 70-30% by the local community. That was again on the ballot in 2016 and passed again with a 70-30% margin. And I have a testifier here who will explain the details.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Please introduce yourself, sir, for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Bob Skillings, the citizen representative of New Ulm Sales Tax Legislation Committee. I'm here today asking for your support of House File 659, the New Ulm Local Excise and Sales and Use Tax Extension. New Ulm is home to 13,500 residents, Shell's Brewery, Sauerkraut Pizza, and Heart of New Ulm. Our community and region have benefited from the local city sales tax since the year 2000, which helped construct and renovate important community assets. In November 2016, 70% of our citizens overwhelmingly voted to extend our city sales tax to support bonding of $14.8 million of regional projects. As you know, community reinvestment and innovation are critical for success in Greater Minnesota. Our commission and other organizations have spent the past 2 years assessing how we can better leverage our existing assets, promote collaboration, realize our potential for economic development, and improve the well-being of our citizens across the region. We are proud to have a slate of regionally significant projects that will positively impact the lives of so many across southern Minnesota. Some examples will include enhancements to our indoor pool that will add handicap accessibility and zero depth entry to provide safety to our seniors and children, a wellness center that will expand opportunities for improved physical and social health for all ages, adding handicapped accessibility and enhancements to our historic Johnson Baseball Park, also a dome facility that will leverage an existing high school artificial turf field and turn a six-month asset into a 12-month asset for the entire region. And then improving accessibility for large groups to tour our internationally recognized Herman the German Park. We love Greater Minnesota, but as we talk with young families, business leaders, and seniors, we know we need to do more to recruit and retain them in great cities like New Ulm. We are striving to provide an environment where our people and businesses can thrive and reach their potential. We respectfully ask you to support the New Ulm region by approving House File 659. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stilling. Anyone else would like to testify on the bill? Questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Frankie renews his motion on House File 659 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Stilling, and Chair Torkelson.
Thank you.
Chair Torkelson has another bill, House File 1469, and Representative Anderson moves that House File 1469 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would hope that possibly Chair Anderson or someone else on your committee would move the striking of Subdivision 2 of this bill. In discussions, we've found that it's not necessary and possibly kind of misconstrues the purpose of this lodging tax. And so if you would so entertain that motion, Mr. Chair, I'd like to strike Subdivision 2.
Chairman Anderson moves that Subdivision 2 in the bill on lines 1.11 through 1.14 be struck from the bill. Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion to strike lines 1.11 through 1.14 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those items, lines are struck. Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill increases the Sleepy Eye lodging tax from 3% to 5%. I have a testifier here who can explain the details of the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and committee members.
Yourself.
Mark Kober, City Manager, City of Sleepy Eye. Mr. Chairman and members, we are a community of 3,500 that suffered two major setbacks in 2015 with the loss of our hotel, which closed, and a major supper club, which was our event center. The City Council immediately set about building a new event center to seat 500 to 600 people, and also rescued the hotel from foreclosure, resold it to a company called Rear Development from Plymouth that has 13 such hotels in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. They're putting $1.2 million into the rehab of the hotel. It's scheduled to be open in April. The city is in the construction phase now of a $4.5 million event center hooked to the hotel, which will be complete in September. What we're asking for is increasing that 3% lodging tax, which would result in about $24,000 a year, to $40,000 a year to further market the community of Sleepy Eye. And we ask for your support in that endeavor.
Thank you. Mr. Kober?
Mr. Kober, yes.
Mr. Kober, okay. Thank you. Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? The members' questions for Mr. Kober or the author? Okay. Hearing none, Representative Anderson renews his motion, House File 1469, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Chair Torkelson and Mr. Kober.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Backer is next on our list.
Thank you.
Okay, House File 1720 is moved. Representative New moves that House File 1720 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Becker.
Chair members, thank you for this opportunity. I've been working on this for nearly a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and it's been one of those bills that seem to be very easy to work on until you get into it. Living in an ag area, I understand the importance of my neighbors because my neighbors are farmers who own the co-op. At the same time, I'm a business owner in a community, so I understand the challenges when you shift taxes onto other people in the community. Businesses like mine have to pick that up. But also, I was a mayor of our community, so I understand the importance of providing services. So this has been a very difficult issue to work on. I have gotten stakeholders together over the last year and a half, have worked with several different individuals to come up with this compromise. And basically what happened, why this came to light is 2015, the Department of Revenue interpret a law that was put on the books in 1992 to exempt ag containment facilities completely. And working with the assessors, working with others, that was never the intent. Like in my area and most parts across the state, ag containments were being assessed for the roof and the wall and the property, and but the chemicals weren't being assessed. So, but there were some parts in the states that wasn't assessing it correctly too. That's why we had the department ruling. We actually had some of this language in last year's tax bill that didn't get signed. So then the exemption went into place. And what my bill does is brings it back to what we had before. And so with that, I do want to let you know that we do have testifiers. I did work with the ag community. We did have an agreement. Now you will hear that's before we had this tax shift. So you will hear some of the stakeholders for and against the bill. So I just want to give that heads up. With that, I will turn it over to testifiers. I think you'll have a few today.
Thank you, Representative Becker. And members, this is an important issue. We heard those who were on the committee the last time may remember this, but we had some testimony last time. I think maybe the department and the assessors will talk to us again today. But this is an item that we have to figure out what we're going to do moving forward on, because we have a situation right now where we have an exemption in law for these facilities that is not being met or interpreted as such in all assessments statewide. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to remember, it was about 50-50, give or take, in some communities where it was actually being counted as an exempted facility, and then others where it was not, if I remember right. Maybe Mr. May and others can talk about when they get
there. And just one more comment.
Representative Becker.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. You know, I think it's closer to maybe 60-40, but the fact is some was doing and some wasn't. The communities, like in my district, you have Chicago, Alberta, Herman, we're seeing a tax shift of anywhere from 7-10% up to 14-15%, and in Miller's district, one community, a 25% tax shift that's going to go on seniors and on other people in that area. Again, I just want to bring it back to what it was, because I know the importance of providing services and trying not to shift the taxes over, and that's what we really worked hard to try to come up with a good compromise. I'll turn it over to Gary.
Thank you, Representative Becker. Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We discussed this issue in our policy development process last year, and our cities unanimously supported clarifying and reducing the exemption for the ag containment facilities. I think you can see that, I provided a handout to the committee, and on the back of that handout, we do itemize the most impacted cities within the state of Minnesota. I should say this is not the totality of cities that are impacted. There are many other cities. I think over 250 cities have some amount of value that is now going to be excluded that was formerly taxed. And Representative Backer's bill, we appreciate him taking the reins of this and helping forge a compromise, or what we thought was a compromise. But this is an essential change change in state law, because this is one of 99 exemptions from the property tax that is contained in our statutes. And the expansion of this has dramatically shifted taxes, beginning with this tax year, 2017 taxes payable. Many of our communities are seeing extremely large shifts in taxes from the ag containment facilities that were formerly taxed to all the other homeowners, small businesses, and apartment owners within their communities. So that shift has occurred because the tax bill last year was vetoed. We had an outright repeal of this exemption in last year's tax bill. This is a narrower but still fairly complete exemption repeal that's contained in the revised backer bill. So we strongly support this bill and would encourage the committee to add this to the division report. Mr. Chair, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for Mr. Carlson before Mr. May comes up? He'll still be here for us to query. Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We also support this compromise bill and want to thank Representative Backer for bringing this issue forward in this bill. I think it's important probably to lay out a little history and explain why assessors may be confused on this issue. In 1992, this exemption was originally passed. And the language at the time did mention portion of the structure needed for the containment. And assessors always interpreted that to mean that is berms, it's catch basins, it's a part of the structure that's a super adequate part that's required to contain spills. But we never envisioned that the buildings, the roofs, the walls would be exempt from taxation. In January 22nd of 2015, there was a bill introduced in the Senate with Senate File 257, and it was introduced by Senator Scully, and it repealed the ag containment exemption effective for payable 2015. Because of this reason, at the time, I think documents show that it was about a $78 million market value impact. In August of 2015, the Department of Revenue issued the bulletin that kind of changed how assessors were supposed to look at these facilities, and possibly included the walls and the roofs into the exemption. On November 4th of 2015, there was a letter sent, signed by Chair Davids of the House Tax Committee and Chair Scully of the Senate Tax Committee, and it was addressed to Commissioner of Revenue Bowerly, and it did express their intent to repeal this exemption in the 2016 legislative session. So assessors, we get one kind of directive, then we get another sort of directive legislatively. In March of 2016, House File 2936 was introduced in the House, and that was a companion to Senate File 257 that repealed the ag containment exemption also for payable 2015. During the 2016 session, assessors were asked by House leadership to work with industry and come up with a compromise language that specifically defined what we felt the legislative intent and what we've been doing for the last 23 years really said. We did develop that language, and it's in the bill 1720 that you see today. For the 2000, the compromise language, and just to make it clear that we still would support repeal. We have no problem with that because in many cases when you look at market value appraisal of facilities, these super adequacies really don't add value if the property were to exchange for an alternate use. It's like any other building. So with that, I can mention I also have talked to the states of Wisconsin and the states of Iowa, their revenue departments. And in those states, these buildings are not exempt from taxation. Certainly the parts that provide pollution control or containment are not valued, but the buildings are not. So with that, I would stand for any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. May. Questions for Mr. May? Mr. May, one question I have, and I think it's kind of an overarching question, is this language bulletproof? Is this language something that we can be assured going forward, if it's placed into law, will be will be enforced, will be utilized consistently? Will it consistently be applied across the state?
Mr. Chair, members, my answer to that would be yes. We feel that it's been developed with both industry and the assessors, and it basically says that those catch basins, those berms, those secondary tanks that are used to contain spills would be exempt, but not the buildings, not the roofs, those other items. And we have consulted with Department of Revenue on that with this language, and we feel that their interpretation would be similar.
Thank you. Other questions, members, for Mr. May? Thank you, Mr. May. Oh, actually, Representative Anderson has a question, Mr. May.
Mr. May.
Thanks. Representative Anderson. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. May, I think you mentioned that this would affect about $70 million in valuation of buildings. Any idea how much would be left in terms of value for the catch basins, the tanks, and the cement berms? So how much would be going down the value of tax-exempt property?
Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think the current estimate's well over $100 million. I think it's about $125 million. When I said the 78, that was back in 15 when the first was introduced. I would tell you this. I still stand by my statement that a lot of these super adequacies, if you look at a market value appraisal of a property, do not add value in exchange. They're simply something that's required to do by law to contain the spill. So whether certain assessors put a value on to exempt them or whether certain assessors simply don't value them, I guess I can't answer that. But I think it's 2010, prior to this issue coming up, I believe the exemption was about $13 or $14 million, according to revenue statistics. And revenue could verify that, but I think that's correct.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Well, in the total of $125 million, the catch basins and berms must be included in that figure. So will assessors have to go back and reassess to, again, make sure that we have this, what's left in the exemption, actually being exempt in terms of value?
Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think it'll take an instructional type of document from revenue. In our negotiations last year with industry, when we talked about compromise language, we also agreed that we would certainly involve industry to provide assessors with basic information about what these containments are all about. Many assessors know, but maybe there's some that really don't. So they're the experts on the issue of containment, and they certainly can provide us with information.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. That includes 10 of the regional center greater Minnesota counties. And as you can see by the document provided by Mr. Gary Carlson, several of our member counties include cities that have these ag containment facilities located with them and have seen the dramatic loss of tax base and the huge increase in tax rates, particularly in the host cities. Consequently, I do also want to thank Representative Backer for introducing this legislation and hopefully getting us back to where we were before the issuance of the Department of Revenue guidance on this subject. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for Mr. Carlson? Thank you. Mr. Bond or Mr. Moyer? Mr. Bond, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Bond. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, which is an organization representing the small agribusinesses and co-ops throughout Minnesota that supply the products and services that Minnesota's 75,000 farmers use every day.
We're here to raise questions about this. We are grateful for Representative Backer working with us for several years now, it turns out. And we are very sympathetic to the cities that are suggesting there are property shifts. We have basically two basic questions, and with me to help ask those questions is Craig Mauer, who will introduce himself in just a minute. The first question is, given the very, very difficult ag economy currently and for the last couple of years, why this bill and why now? Let's look at the bill's premise. In 1992, the state of Minnesota determined that it made sense, given the requirements that they were now putting on these small agribusinesses, to put containment around chemicals that had been defined as hazardous waste when they're outside of their containment. The state of Minnesota said, you know, you deserve to have a tax exemption for that portion of your property. Understand, significant property taxes are still paid by these facilities every year. So what has happened is we found out that the assessment system, the Department of Revenue and county assessors apparently neglected, didn't understand, or whatever, as you heard, a significant number of them to actually apply this exemption to the property. So now the answer is, let's get rid of the exemption or reduce it. It just, the logic escapes. Second, proponents say, well, we never intended to cover dry fertilizer. You understand, back in those days, it was primarily liquid chemicals. And understand, it's not only chemicals such as chemicals that you use for pesticides, but also fertilizers defined in the statute as a chemical, an ag chemical. So what has happened is, as we've gotten to use, and farmers have found a lot more effective, cost-effective fertilizers in dry fertilizers that are more sensitive to the environment, essentially what's happening is when that dry fertilizer is mixed with water, which is what happens in a flood like down in Rushford several years ago, or just last week in Clark's Grove, Minnesota, when a tornado tore the roof off the building and water mixed with it, it is now, without the containment that they had paid to put in place, it is now a hazardous waste going into the environment, and it is a liquid chemical agricultural product. With that, I'd like to introduce Craig Mauer, who's with the facility and has spent the last week trying to clean up that mess. Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Bond. Mr. Mauer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your time and over the past year and a half working with us. Representative Backer, thank you. In regards
Mr.
to...
Mr. Mauer, if you'd introduce yourself.
I am Craig Mauer. I am representing the Minnesota Crop Retailers Association. Also, am a retailer in the state of Minnesota and been in that part of my life for 42 years. So, anyway, regards to adding to what Bill said, the containment, as you see in the pictures of what containment does, in essence of a storm, tornado, or any a fire or whatever, you can see how the containment has kept the fertilizer chemicals in the catch basins and in properties. It's not part of runoff. It is not into a storm sewer. It's not onto people's property, and it's not running down a road ditch. These containment systems work. We spend a lot of money building them. They're engineered, and they do what we ask, what they're built to do. So the Clark's Grove incident was a very unfortunate incident that happened in the past week and a half right in front of a planting season, and consequently that facility to us is unusable, and we look to rebuild that, but the parts of the containment that were put into that operation did the job it was supposed to, and that's why they're put there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mauer. So, Mr. Mauer, and I think this is kind of the essence of what we have before us. My understanding and my recollection is that this exemption was put in place in response to state mandates upon businesses that required them to put these types of berms and other types of containment, special containment provisions on the buildings, and the exemption came in response to that added burden on those businesses. And it seems to me that Representative Backer has in his bill clarity around making certain that we continue to fully exempt those special accommodations for those buildings to contain this stuff. Does this bill do that?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members? Thank you both.
Thank you.
And please stay tuned. There might be questions. Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I didn't intend to testify, so I'm sorry about surprising you, Representative Backer. And I'll be brief. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify that the Department of Revenue did not decide in 2015 that these should be taxable. The Department of Revenue communicated what is under current law to county assessors. And, Mr. Chair, as you know, we have one of the most, if not the most, complicated property tax systems in the country. And we work as hard as we can in order to be partners with our local units of government and ensuring that we're doing the best job possible, ensuring all laws across the state are applied equitably and equally. So I just wanted to make sure that the record was clear that we did not provide a new interpretation of the law. We were just providing what is provided under the law. Mr. Chair, I think that the language that is drafted here today is a good attempt, but I wouldn't call this bulletproof. We would want to, you know, if we go and talk to the Department of Agriculture, they're going to say that, you know, any structure within any of these ag containment facilities, you know, are needed in order to contain chemicals. So, you know, they're going to say the bathroom is the one part in these sort of ag containment facilities that wouldn't be needed. And so if we look at, you know, in terms of what is a berm or what is a catch basin, you know, these are types of things that we would continue to want to think about and talk about. The clearest approach, Mr. Chair, is the approach that was negotiated and put into the tax bill that was enacted. The tax bill that was passed but not enacted. And finally, Mr. Chair, I wanted to just say that these facilities are no longer small sheds or tanks. They can be sheds or tanks, but they also can be superstructures within facilities, within communities, and they do take up city services. Roads and bridges, you know, service these facilities. Fire and police protect these facilities. So ensuring that there is some way in order to think about what is the appropriate level of taxation in order to ensure that we can both have productive economies, support the needs within cities, and then also make sure that they're not only assessed appropriately, but also taxed appropriately. We look forward to continuing the discussion. We'd be open to a bulletproof way of trying to find a way in between here, but it is important that we do find clarity, because after 4 years of talking about something and then to have something that's not clear in order to have something that's not clear is something that we would want to avoid, but we're willing to get there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions for Mr. Cummings, members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, in the Department of Revenue, summary of the bill, at the bottom it says the increase in market value would be approximately $125 million for taxes payable in 2018. But in the bill itself, at the effective date 1.14, it says this section is effective for taxes payable in 2016. I think there is an exception given if they've already had the exemption in 2016. But could you explain, or could somebody explain, it seems to me, the differences in those two interpretations?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to phone a friend.
Mr. Ouellette. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Ouellette. I'm the Property Tax Research Director at the Department, and my team prepares the revenue estimates. The $125 million is based on a survey of counties where we got estimates based on the 2017 assessment of what they thought these facilities would be worth. Actually, it was done a year ago, so it's a 2016 assessment. So in terms of preparing the estimate, the effective date does have a retroactive effective date, but my understanding, based on conversations with our legal department, is that absent any specific language in the bill that says how you would change taxes that are already spread, that this would just affect how values are spread prospectively. The effective date would sort of hold harmless the values that have already been used for taxes that have already been spread, but the new language would kick in for assessment 17, taxes payable 18. Does that answer your question?
Representative Anderson?
Well, thanks again, Mr. Chair. And yeah, it does explain it, but again, with language saying effective in 2016, then what about 2017? I'm sure the statements are in the process of being put out, but even though the bill says 2016, it won't affect payable 2017 either. Is that correct?
Mr. Watt?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, my understanding is if you want the retroactive effective date to re-levy taxes on taxes that have already been spread, we would need additional language that would instruct the counties to apply the tax rates to this value that had been exempt when they prepared the tax rolls. It can be done, but we think that you would need additional language to make that happen. There isn't general language that allows you to recalculate property taxes after they've already been spread.
Chair Anderson.
No, okay, Mr. Chair, that does clarify it. I'm not saying they should go back, but it just seems to be a little bit murky in the wording of the bill.
Other questions, members, for the department? Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I can explain a little bit why the pay 16 date is there. That many of our counties in Minnesota have tax petitions that were filed by industry for the pay 16 year. So they could do that up until prior to May 1st of 16. So once the bulletin went out and the issue came to the forefront, many petitions were filed. And what we were trying to avoid with that effective date is an issue where a building and a roof and structure is taxable. It goes exempt for 2 years and then comes back to taxable again. So we're trying to kind of avoid that whiplash situation that would occur if those were moved forward.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Mr. Bond has a statement.
Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, if the committee does want to add this language, and we raise questions about its necessity, because we think, in fact, the Department of Revenue memo clarified very much with pictures exactly what was intended by the law, and we think the law was appropriate as it was passed in 92. If you're intent on adding language, we would encourage you to consider, and Representative Backer has worked with us, the secondary and primary structures need to be defined in law, or this particular bill will actually create more confusion. And I base that on attorneys that have litigated this now in several courts as they've tried to define what is covered and what isn't. So we would have some suggestions there.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to testify on the bill? Any other questions, members? Thank you, Representative Backer. Final comments?
No, thank you. As you can see, that we've gone through quite a process working with all stakeholders, and would appreciate your consideration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative New renews her motion on House File 1720, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Backer.
Thank you, committee.
Representative Johnson, House File 613. Representative Carlson moves that House File 613 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The House File 613 would allow the City of North Mankato to impose a food and beverage tax. And I have with me today John Harrington, the City Manager of North Mankato.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Mr. Harrington, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Herrenstein. I am the city administrator of North Mankato, Minnesota.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss North Mankato's request to authorize collection of a food and beverage tax of up to 1%. Since 1985, North Mankato has operated the Caswell Sports Complex, a nationally recognized sporting facility for softball, and a facility that in 2013 also began hosting statewide soccer tournaments. The Caswell Complex has served two important roles in its history. First, it serves the local needs of adult and youth softball and soccer. Second, because of the quality of the park constructed by the city in 1985 and then again expanded in 2013, the facility is an attraction and source of tourism for regional, statewide, and national visitors. For instance, last year marked the 25th anniversary. The Minnesota Girls State Softball High School Tournament was hosted at Caswell Park, and the Caswell Sporting Complex also hosted the 2016 North American Fast Pitch Association's World Series, bringing 83 total teams from 23 states and 4 provinces of Canada. In 2016, Caswell Park drew 65,000 visitors to the Mankato-North Mankato area, and it is estimated that the economic benefit of these visitors was approximately $7 million to local businesses in the area. Caswell Park is an important part of the regional sporting and tourism economy pursued jointly between North Mankato and our sister city of Mankato. In 2016, voters overwhelmingly, which was above 70% approval in both communities, voters overwhelmingly approved a sales tax extension that included, among other items, dollars for construction of regional recreational facilities to meet rising local needs, to enhance the quality of life of our residents, and to hopefully provide amenities desired by workers we are seeking to attract to the region. We seek the authority to consider implementing a 1% food and beverage tax to fund operating, maintenance, and capital costs of the park. North Mankato's request is aimed at achieving regional funding equity and coordination of dollars that can support shared regional assets that enjoy broad public support. We are requesting a 1% authorization to achieve revenue and taxing parity with our sister city, Mankato, that also shares the 1% authorization. While Mankato has a 1% authorization, only a 0.5% has been imposed. If a decision by the North Mankato City Council is made to implement the tax, North Mankato will target our rate of the tax with our sister city of 0.5%, an amount that will generate approximately $50,000 annually and affect approximately 13 businesses in our community. I'd also like to emphasize that local residents also fund the Caswell Park complex with local property tax dollars and fees to use the facility. This tax is not aimed at gathering fees to support a facility simply from visitors. This request is being made similarly to the joint legislative request of both North Mankato and Mankato between the legislature this year to extend our community sales tax that was, again, as I mentioned earlier, overwhelmingly approved by voters. Thank you, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Herrenstein. Questions, members, for Mr. Herrenstein or the author? Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Herrenstein, just for clarity's sake, did you say that the tax would be imposed in both Mankato and North Mankato? And then I see the bill only references North Mankato.
Mr. Herrenstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the tax authorizes tax to be imposed in North Mankato. The city of Mankato has had a food and beverage tax authorization since 2008 and has implemented 0.5% of their 1% authority. So what we are doing is seeking regional parity and a regional approach in this approach to the food and beverage tax.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Herrenstein, thank you. Well, it's just nice to see a regional tax like this can be supported by both communities. So thank you.
Other questions, members? Anyone else who'd like to testify on the bill? Representative Johnson, closing thoughts?
Thank you for the opportunity to present this.
Thank you. With that, Representative Carlson renews the motion House File 613 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you both. Representative Gunther, House File 738. Representative Barr moves that House File 738 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Gunther. Chair Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a sales tax that the city of Fairmont to impose a local sales tax for various projects, and we have the city administrator, Mike Humpel, here to describe what those projects are.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Welcome, Mr.
Humpel.
Mr. Humpel, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, and thank you for having me today. Fairmont's a community built around five lakes. Recreation is important to the overall health of our community. Fairmont is looking at several recreational projects that will enhance our existing amenities, lakes, trails, and parks. Fairmont's also looking at a community center in the process of developing plans for a community center. Enhancing our amenities and the development of a new community center create a financial need of about $30 million. To help fund these projects, the community voted 61% in favor of a local option sales tax of 0.5% in November. I'd like to just encourage the committee to support the citizens of Fairmont in House File 738, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Humpel. Questions, members? Can you give us your full name, Mr. Humpel? And your
Mike Humpel, position? City Administrator, City of Fairmont.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering if you could just describe for us what the definition is of a community center in your community. I've seen that on a number of other proposals, and I'm just trying to get a better picture of what that means in a community like yours.
Right now, Fairmont's a regional center for about a 50-mile radius. What we're looking at is our ice arena is getting old, so an indoor ice arena, swimming pool, community hall, senior center.
Thank you.
Representative Walker.
Thank you.
Other questions, members? Anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Hearing none. Chair Gunther, closing comments.
I appreciate your support.
Thank you. Representative Barr renews her motion. House File 738 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you both. Representative Fenton, House File 1057. Oh, and members, the goodies in the box were from Representative Pryor, and she is going to be presenting a bill tonight, so thank her in the meantime. And very, very gratuitous. Representative Fenton, House File 1057. Representative Rarick moves that House File 1057 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm happy to be here to present House File 1057. This is a bill to direct part of the proceeds of a lodging tax to a capital project in Woodbury. And this project will benefit tourism, the East Metro, and Woodbury. As members may know, the state already allows cities to impose a 3% lodging tax without coming to the legislature. And over 100 cities in Minnesota impose a lodging tax. What House File 1057 does is directs a portion of the lodging receipts to a capital project. A number of cities across the state have received similar legislation. And in the past, the Woodbury City Council has already voted to support this legislation. And we are currently in the process of working with nonpartisan staff to provide an end date to be included in this. And with that, I have Mayor Mary Stevens of Woodbury with me to address the committee for a few minutes. And I also have with us is our Woodbury City Manager, Clint Gridley, if there are any further questions. And with that, I'll turn it over.
Mr. Chair, committee members.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Welcome, Mayor Stevens.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Mary Giuliani Stevens, Mayor of Woodbury. Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for hearing this today. I just want to start saying we are not asking for more than the 3% that is currently allowed under the lodging tax law. What we're asking for is flexibility to allow a portion of the 3%, that'd be 2% of it, for capital improvements related to tourism, so the banquet rooms, the meeting space, and the visitor center, which would benefit the hospitality industry. The 1% would be used for marketing. And as Representative Fenton said, our plan is to sunset the capital portion in that amount. So we're working with the Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Minnesota Lodging Association to clarify those items, that the 1% would be used for marketing and that there would be an end date on the capital portion. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other testifiers, Representative Fenn?
Not at this time.
Commissioner McElroy is here. Commissioner McElroy, you're going to pinch hit here.
Mr. Chairman and members, although my name is Dan McElroy, I represent the Minnesota Lodging Association. I appreciate you using kind of the historic honorific, but I haven't been a commissioner for a very long time, and probably prefer the title Mr. these days. But I'm here on behalf of the Lodging Association. We have a concern about this because of the precedent it would establish. We circulated a 2012 report that Ms. Dalton did about the history of lodging taxes. There are five communities that have some grandfathered rights, but since the statewide bill, 469.190, and interestingly, the local option lodging tax is codified under economic development, not under property tax, not under community revenue. It's codified as part of our economic development strategy as a state. We've been successful in being as consistent as government is almost ever able to be in preserving all of those funds, or 95% of them, as is required by the statute, for use in marketing communities. And I get asked by mayors and city managers, aren't we simply offloading a hotel's marketing budget onto their guests? In a little, but you need to understand how communities are affected by the people who come and stay in our hotels and motels and bed and breakfast inns. According to research done by Explore Minnesota Tourism, for every dollar a traveler, business traveler or vacationer spends, 21 cents is spent on lodging, and 79% are spent on all the other things they buy in their community. Gas and oil for their automobile, or I guess oil is old-fashioned, gas for their automobile, or fuel, meals and shopping and other expenses. It is good for communities' economies, if not necessarily for their governments, to have a robust lodging community. We're very concerned about the precedent this would establish. Now, there have been discussions with Representative Fenton in the city about changing the language so it might be to market the event center or the Central Park. We're more than happy to work on that. But we asked the community or the committee to join us in working to keep these lodging taxes as focused as possible. Every community in Minnesota has needs that they would like to address, whether they're band shelters or 4th of July fireworks or paying for marching band uniforms or preserving other infrastructure. And many have looked to the lodging tax over the years, and we have so far been successful in working with the legislature to keep them focused on what they were originally passed for. There are, I believe, 105 approximately lodging taxes, five of them grandfathered, the other 100 used for marketing purposes.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy.
Thank you.
I'll still call you Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else would like to testify on the bill? Members, questions for Mayor Stevens, the author, or Mr. McElroy? Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to speak in support of Woodbury. This is a good... totally lost myself now. The facility is used by a lot of different places, a lot of different cities, other things. So however they need to word this to get done what they need to do, I'm in full support of helping you out here. So
thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments, members? Okay, hearing none, Representative Fenton, any final comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I just thank you and urge your support.
Thank you. With that, Representative Rarick renews the motion. The House File 1057 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Representative Fenton and Chair McElroy. Representative Chair Hamilton, House File 1283. Welcome, Chair Hamilton. We'll get the bill before us here in just a moment. Representative Whalen moves at House File 1283 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And what we're looking at doing here is we do have an existing local option sales tax, and we're going to ask for an extension of that. And we've added a petition process to require a referendum in the event that there are local concerns about the extension of this sales tax authority. And in essence of time, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton. Please introduce yourself, sir, for the record, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, Steve Robinson, the city administrator in Worthington. We just want to thank you for your consideration of this bill. We have experienced a huge diversity in Worthington over the past two or three decades. With that, many of our park and recreational facilities don't quite meet the needs and the desires of our population. And we're looking at using these additional sales tax revenues to enhance our recreational and park facilities that will better meet the needs of our citizens. We have become the home of a regional center for both youth and adult soccer each weekend during the summer. Our adult soccer league brings in 300 to 400 people from around the region for games, and we need facilities to help accommodate those activities for many of our people, and that's the premise of what we're asking for, the extension of the sales tax.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Please introduce yourself, sir, for the record.
My name is Mike Cooley. I'm the mayor of Worthington, Minnesota. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for letting me testify today. This local option sales tax that was put in place some 8 years ago has been very successful and very popular within our community to provide the amenities that was stated for. But what it does is it helps our community. We've been able to stay fiscally responsible because in addition to these amenities paid by the option sales tax, we've put in place a new fire hall, a new aquatic center that we've used our other financial resources for while keeping our tax levy at the very minimum. So it's important for us to extend this option sales tax for at least the rest of the 22 months to help us, you know, cater to our changing demographics in the city of Worthington. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Cooley. Questions, members, for either testifiers or the author? Anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Representative New.
Representative Hamilton, I'm just wondering why this didn't go before the voters.
Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it did initially. We did have a voter referendum initially, and there was a cap of, it was 10 years or a cap of $6 million is what was on the ballot, and it did pass overwhelmingly. We've already, we've met that, or we're close to meeting that $6 million threshold before the 10 years is up. And so now we're looking to extend that for the full 10 years. And so we're asking to go over that $6 million cap to invest it in some of the things that we just mentioned. And so, like I said, we did add a petition process in here that would require a referendum in the event there was local concerns about the extension of what we're trying to do here. So, we were all on board with asking for a voter referendum for the initial process, and that's why we wanted to put this in here as well, in case there's any pushback or opposition locally.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay. None. Chair Hamilton, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee for your time and thoughtful discussion, and I ask for your support.
Okay, with that, Representative Wayland renews her motion of the House File 1283 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson, your bill next. Will that work for you?
I assume.
Chair Anderson moves his bill. I think we did that one already.
Is it 1556?
15, yep. House file 1556. Chair Anderson, or Representative Anderson moves that House file 1556 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill this morning. Okay. This bill just gives counties the same authority that cities currently have in making their county departments speak to each other, a recorder, and land use, zoning, and such, to make sure that we don't have parcels that don't fit, don't work before somebody tries to build on them. It just could save a lot of headaches down the road for folks. And I have a testifier here who would like to more explain the bill.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record, sir, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Leary, and I am the zoning administrator for Blue Earth County. And thank you for hearing this bill. Basically, what it does is it allows the counties the authority to review the proposed lot splits before they are recorded, make sure that they are in compliance with all the requirements of each individual county. And as Representative Anderson mentioned, it does have the it will save a lot of heartburn for a number of property owners who split properties that have some unintended consequences. For example, on the handout that's given to you, it could be a property line that's put over the middle of a structure of some sort. Maybe the structure doesn't meet the property line requirements and other criteria of zoning ordinances. So we're just asking for the same authority that's given to cities and townships, and I'm available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Leary. Questions for Mr. Leary, members? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and intended testifier. So with this, were you able to review this? This could also trigger an inspection of a septic system or something. If you were to look at a deed or something coming through, could that also at that point trigger an inspection of either the water system or the septic system?
Mr. Leary.
That is correct. That system is in place already. When a property is transferred, a property is split, that triggering mechanism is already in place.
Okay. So thank this you. Wouldn't be any additional burdens. Representative Marker?
That's correct.
Thanks. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question, too. So right now cities overview the lot splits. So this would allow the counties to do that as well. On top of it, could the county trump whatever the city then decides, or how does that work if they're in conflict?
Mr. Leary.
The county zoning authority is separate from the city, so only areas that we would have zoning authority over would be the rural areas that are not under city jurisdiction. Thank so there you. Should be no conflict.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you.
Other questions, members? Representative Hertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would be, would there be an additional fee imposed for the county review other than what is initially spent to do the simple lot split?
Mr. Leary?
I'm not aware of any additional fee.
Representative Hertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions, members? Okay, hearing none. Anyone else who wants to testify in this bill? Chair Anderson renews his motion that House File 1556 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Members, we're upon the hour of 10 o'clock. We're going to reconvene this evening at
6:30.
At 6:30, right in the same room. So we will see you here after supper. We do call it supper back home, don't we, Representative Marquardt? Yeah, we do. With that, the committee is in recess until 6:30 p.m. Members, I call the meeting of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division back to order. And we will begin with Representative Pryor's bill, House File 1566. Representative Pryor, we have to thank you for the treats. people.
It paid off then. I got to be first up.
You did? Thank you. Yes. The skids for your bill are greased.
All right.
And so we actually, Representative Carlson will move that House File 1566 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome again, Representative Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Lori Pryor, representative of 48A. I have House File 1566, and there is an amendment to House File 1566 that I would like to support.
Okay. The A2 amendment.
Yes.
Representative Carlson moves adoption of the A2 amendment to House File 1566. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Pryor.
So the A2 amendment just updated the income brackets with the February forecasts. So moving on, this amendment, what we're addressing is keeping housing affordable. And we're keeping housing affordable by providing tax relief to both homeowners and renters. And this bill increases the homestead credit refunds and also the renter property refunds. First up, the homestead credit. And you see in Section 1, this is addressing the homestead credit. The homestead credit is a state-paid refund that provides tax relief to homeowners whose property tax is high relative to their incomes. So what you see is for each income bracket, the amount of the maximum refund would increase. So for the people with the highest income, but income relative to their property tax, the maximum refund is $520. People at the lowest income bracket, the maximum refund would be $3,000. So that is the increased, those are increased amounts from what now exists in statute. Moving on is the, I will say too that there is some adjustment to in these brackets, and what you see is that the incomes between $68,330 and $100,000, there's a change there, and the income threshold percentages used to determine eligibility are being decreased. And the effect of what's happening here is that there's more brackets now, and it's a more gradual movement through the different income brackets. There's more steps. Then in the renter's property tax refund, the renter's property tax is a state-paid refund that provides tax relief to renters whose rent and implicit property taxes are high relative to their incomes. The maximum refunds will be moved up, and depending on income bracket, will range from $210 to $3,000. And I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Just following your table. Anyone who would like to testify on House File 1566? Questions, members? Okay. Representative Pryor, thank you. With that, Representative Carlson renews his motion that House File 1566 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Lewick, House File 533, Representative New moves that House File 533 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 533 would implement a local use sales tax that was passed on referendum by the good folks at the Garrison Cathio West Mille Lacs Lake Sanitary District. Back in the past prior, general election. The reason that they those citizens decide to go forward with that, their sanitary district is struggling with finances, and they're in a situation where this is another opportunity to make sure that sanitary district stays whole. Basically, they've got 1,000. They designed a system years ago
to 1,000 hookups. They've only been able to hook up about 500 people, and so they've got a long-term funding issue. This will definitely help that. I actually attend their meetings on a monthly basis, except since we've been in session. We've refinanced our the bonds and reduced the interest that they paid. So they've made the hard decision to tax themselves, but to make that put that into final effect, it obviously has to go into statute. With that, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. Anyone like to testify on this bill? House File 533. Questions, members? Hearing none, Representative New renews her motion that House File 533 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Lewick.
Mr. Chair, members?
Representative Marquardt, would you like to do your bill on accreditation?
Sure.
Representative Marquardt moves that his bill, House File 1431, be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And we're revisiting an issue that you've actually heard the last couple years, but a little different approach. And the issue goes back to in 2013, there was a law passed that would require all assessors by 2019 or within 4 years of getting the certified Minnesota assessor's license to get an accredited Minnesota assessor license. And so you've heard a number of approaches. One was Representative Lewick's, who completely repeals that part. What I'm offering here is another approach that the assessors have gotten together, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Department of Revenue have all come together with kind of another approach. But before we move further, one thing you have to remember is that the property tax is the one tax that the government sets the base upon which the tax rate applies. So it's serious business. So you want to make sure that people who are assessing your property are qualified to do that. And I know Senator Scoy, I think, is the one who did the 2013 bill to require assessors to have kind of this third-tier approach. And we had a bit of an issue in Becker County, one of the counties that I represent a part of. And we had a taxpayer group that was very concerned about the discrepancies in the various values placed on homes and so forth. And they had come to both Senator Scoy and also myself in saying, we've got to do something about this. We've got to improve the field on assessment. So that's kind of where it came from. So you have residents who are very, very concerned that things are done just right. And yet what Representative Lewick is looking at is also the impact it has on counties. You know, it's costs for training and all these things. And in small counties, you necessarily need this assessor that, you know, you might have an X amount of commercial industrial property. You may not need assessors to do this. It might be an overkill. So anyway, here's what this bill does. It's kind of a in-between, if you will. But what it does, it extends this deadline for assessors to move to this CMA, if you will, from 2019 to 2022, gives a three-year further extension. It says that if you get the certified medical Minnesota assessor's license, you'd have 5 years instead of four to move to the CMA level. And then thirdly, it creates a waiver. So if you've got, and I always get these mixed up, a certified Minnesota assessors, which is kind of the basic one, and I know the assessors will maybe disagree with that, but I'm looking at kind of this bottom level here, that you can get a waiver, which would last until 2032 if you follow a number of criteria. and they're listed here in the bill. So I know we've got some testifiers here that would want to talk to this, but it's kind of a middle approach, if you will, between requiring everyone to do this, which might be an overkill for a lot of smaller counties, but completely repealing it. I do think there's good merit in making sure the assessors we have are as qualified as they can be for the sake of the taxpayer. But I know, I think there's probably some, Mr. Hilgert from the Association of Minnesota Counties is here.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Welcome, Mr. Hilgert.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. The Association of Minnesota Counties represents all Minnesota's 87 counties. I think Representative Marquardt did much of the heavy lifting on this one. This is really just a compromise effort on kind of two sides of an issue that has proven to be a little bit contentious here at the legislature. As you know, the 2013 law change happened a bit ago. However, full implementation of that does not occur until 2019. We have several, our membership is divided on this issue. I would say a great portion of our rural members are very concerned. Our suburban and metro counties are full-fledged support of the law or neutral. And so AMC has been kind of in that unique position of hearing it on all different perspectives. There are three bills that we know that are moving right now at the legislature. One, again, as referenced, Representative Lewick's full repeal. One in the Senate that is kind of an attempt for middle ground as well that would provide an exemption for counties that have less than 1,000 commercial industrial parcels. So saying that if you don't have tons of complex properties, then maybe you don't need all your assessors AMA certified. And then this bill that I want to thank Representative for Marquardt bringing today too, which is basically the attempt from the Department of Revenue, Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, and AMC to find some kind of solution in the middle ground. So with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgert. Questions for Mr. Hilgert or the author? Mr. Hilgert, I got it right. Mr. Hilgert, one question quickly, and I think this is a good discussion. I appreciate additional ideas beyond what we've had so far, for sure. Has anybody talked yet about maybe having the laws, the current approach continue as it is, and then allowing counties to somehow opt out of it? Maybe a referendum or something, or the commissioner vote or something. Has that been discussed?
Mr. Chair, members, I've not heard that idea before. We'd definitely be interested in thinking about it. Regarding a referendum, the only thing that would strike me as a concern is thinking about the public and their knowledge potentially of AMA certification levels and assessor accreditation levels. It might be something that is so technical that would be difficult to take a vote on.
Okay, any other questions, members? Okay, Representative Mark. Oh, Mr. May, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May, representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We certainly want to thank Representative Marquardt for bringing this proposal forward. As he mentioned, this is a compromise effort that the assessors, the Department of Revenue, and AMC got together last year and put together on this issue. I want to assure you that the MAO fully supports education and professionalism. As we move forward, we've, since 2013, really revamped our whole education system to help all assessors throughout the state attain this AMA designation. We fully have our sights on 2019, but we certainly understand some of the issues moving forward. So the extra time that this bill allows and the waiver potential that it allows for those long-time employees who do not want to pursue AMA, we're certainly supportive of. So we, again, support this bill 100% and thank Representative Marquardt for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. May. Other questions for Mr. May? Representative Marquardt? Additional testifiers, I'm sorry. Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And we, too, would like to thank Representative Marquardt for keeping this discussion alive. I want to make it clear that I think our members would still support Representative Lewick's bill, the full repeal, but this at least does have the conversation of moving past having to have ultra-high rigid standards in areas where it simply isn't being used. And so this does take a middle approach, and we appreciate that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to testify? Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for continuing the discussion on this. And this is just another option, because you do have citizens that come into Board of Equalization meetings and they're really talking about how their property was assessed as it was. So it's kind of, you know, those folks really concerned over here versus the practicality of it and how it influences counties and so forth and costs and training. And so one thing, the date of 2032 seems a long ways into the future, that you could be waived or you could have the CMA and not have to get the AMA until that time. It's kind of, let's say you're 60 years old right now and you say, okay, 50, you know, you're not going to do anything. But if you're 35 or 40, you're going to realize ultimately you'd have to get to the higher level. So thank you for this discussion and just for consideration for the division.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings.
Very briefly, I just want to make sure that we're on the record, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager with Minnesota Department of Revenue. We appreciate Representative Marquardt bringing forward this this bill. This bill is something that we think we could agree to in the end. The department's position is that we support current law, and we think that that is can be moved forward, and we're working with our local partners to do that. But we understand Representative Marquardt's bill. In fact, we worked on it. and as an endpoint, this is something that we think that could work.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. With that, Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 1431 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Representative Keel on House File 1367. Representative Whalen moves that House File 1367 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a sales tax bill that was passed, I believe, last year. A little background on it. East Grand Forks proposed a sales tax, a local sales tax in use. Actually, the intent is to pay for a swimming pool that they have now redone. It was in poor shape, and they made it handicapped accessible. They brought a voters' election through on March 7th of 2016, and it was overwhelmingly approved by the citizens in East Grand Forks. Their intent is to pay for... This will just pay for the swimming pool. I believe it lasts 5 years of possible sales tax. And then once the bill is actually paid, once the pool costs are paid for, then that's it. They don't collect any more sales tax. It is directly for just the swimming pool costs. And the reason that they were so anxious to use a sales tax is East Grand Forks has a rather large park that a lot of our friends to the north, the Canadians, come down and use as their hotel. It's like an outdoor hotel. And it is packed in the summer. And, of course, one of the things they do is use a swimming pool that is a part of East Grand Forks. And a lot of people go there and use that out of city and do a lot of shopping within East Grand Forks. So kind of their way of covering the costs for this, along with some fundraising they've done previous. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Keel. Anyone who would like to testify on this bill, House File 1367. Representative Keel, one question that came up, has the city already bonded for the project? And if so, we could take the bonding language out of the bill.
Oh, I have to check on that. I think.
Could you just let us know and then we could, if it does move forward, we can act accordingly.
I kind of think they borrowed from another fund. But I have to check on that again. I'll have to confirm that.
Okay. Thank you. Questions, members? Okay. Hearing none, Representative Whalen renews her motion. House File 1367 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Runbeck, House File 112. Representative Erickson moves that House File 112 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did hand out my testimony this morning. I don't know if folks still have it or if they'd like it, but my testifier could not be here. But thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 112 is a truth in bonding bill. Puts more of a check and a balance into the whole process when local municipalities decide to use a lease revenue financing mechanism when they build a city hall or a fire hall or a public works building, any kind of public facility. And under current law, when cities do choose that mechanism, the lease revenue financing, there is no requirement to do a public hearing, and there is no opportunity for a referendum should the citizens decide that this is not something they approve of. And, of course, we know that under general obligation, GO bonds, which is the more traditional form of bonding in cities, that there is a requirement for a public, there is a requirement for a referendum. And this comes out of several instances around the metro and around the state when this has occurred. The most recent was probably Forest Lake. And what they did there was very quietly brought forward a proposal, and it passed on a 3-2 vote, a $30 million plan to develop a property for the city that the city intended to lease to itself. So that's the idea of the mechanism. And citizens were quite outraged, and they did in a couple days get 1,000 signatures on a petition. But the petition was rejected by the council because it's not required by law. The citizens took the city to court. They lost in court, but again, because there's no statute that says that cities, that this, what I call an end-around mechanism, is not approved. And so this is a very modest mechanism, and we did change. I have an amendment, I believe that would be in your packet, so that we raise the bar just a bit more on the number of signatures for the petition and what that is, what vote that's based on.
Okay.
So it would be based on a general election.
Chair Runbeck, we have the A1 amendment. Representative Erickson moves that the A1 amendment be adopted. Discussion on the A1 amendment. Hearing none, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank Representative Runbeck for the amendment and looking at that trigger.
And thank you, Representative Joaquin. You helped with that.
Other questions or comments on the amendment, members? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, that's really the bill. the purpose is to say that we need to be more upfront and honest with taxpayers when we are issuing debt and obligating, putting obligations of that on the taxpayer.
Thank you. Anyone like to testify on this bill? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Runbeck for meeting with me to discuss some of the concerns we have with this bill. I'd like the committee to know that the authority to enter into lease purchase has been around in some way, shape, or form since about 1965, so this is a longstanding authorization in state law. And the financing tool is frequently used for facilities like administrative buildings, public works facilities, some of the facilities that are not always supported by the citizenry but are necessary for the operation of government. This tool has also been used for some of the multi-jurisdictional facilities. The one that I know has been pointed to several times is the Super Rink up in Blaine. That was financed in a lease purchase arrangement among a number of different jurisdictions up there. And this bill would just make it more difficult in some circumstances based upon the reverse referendum requirement. I do want to say that I do thank Representative Runbeck for modifying the threshold on the referendum. I pointed out in the GovOps committee that we could have quite a bit of fluctuation in the number of voters turning out from a general election if it includes federal or state officials versus just local officials. So I do appreciate you raising that threshold per the comments I raised. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would just stand for any questions. I thank Representative Runbeck for working with me on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Mr. Carlson, number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the greater Minnesota regional center counties and 4 counties here in the metropolitan area. I also want to thank Representative Runbeck for meeting with me to discuss this bill and for the amendment that she did offer. It makes the bill somewhat less onerous. Nevertheless, we continue to oppose the bill. The committee members probably know many of the facilities that counties operate, such as courthouses and jails, do not enjoy wide public support. As a consequence, the flexibility that's afforded by the current statute has been utilized for both constructing jails as well as courthouses in the past and would be appreciated to be continued in the future. I will mention that counties do have authority right now to issue bonds for the construction of jails right now, but that authority is constrained so that the tax-based poor communities likely could not afford to just exercise that authority. That would include the counties of Lake of the Woods, Manoman, Red Lake, that based on a 4% 20-year bond, could only raise $9 million. That's not going to build a jail. Clearwater, Kuching, and Wadena could only raise 12. Again, it's questionable whether or not that would build a jail. And finally, Roseau County could only raise $16 million. Unfortunately, not only do locals have a role in determining jails, we are under regulation by the Department of Corrections in our jail facilities, and in many instances in the past, they have dinged us for having inadequate facilities and effectively required us to either rehab or replace the facilities. So we do have a significant mandate. The same is true with courthouses. We are under law required to provide the court facilities for the state judiciary. So, again, we'd appreciate retaining the current flexibility that the law provides. I'll conclude there on behalf of answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions, members, for Mr. Carlson? Thank you. Anyone else would like to testify on the bill? Hearing none, any final questions for members? Chair Runbeck, any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I would just say that debt generated, no matter how, at least a financing mechanism being one, is still debt, and the citizens should be able to have some interaction.
Thank you. Thank you for this bill, Representative Runbeck. I think this is a very good bill. We in Wabasha County had a jail built, and one of those items that the two Carlson brothers had talked about, that maybe sometimes the Chair David calls them the Carlson brothers, and they smile about it, so I think we're okay. At least Gary does. I see that. Anyway, in Wabasha County, what happened, there was a jail, and there was widespread opposition to the jail, but also widespread understanding because there was a lot of different hearings and community meetings held about that over a number of months, maybe over a year. And so it was a very deliberate process with the citizenry, who was very clearly opposed. And when it came down to paying for it, instead of going through the capital improvement process that is exposed to the reverse referendum, they basically went around that group of people, which was very large throughout the county, and utilized lease purchase financing through an HRA or an EDA, and it happens over and again. So your bill addresses it directly, and thank you for that. Members, with that, Representative Erickson renews her motion that House File 112 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Chair Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Marquardt, you want to do another one? Representative Marquardt moves that House File 1930 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pryor gave an excellent explanation of the property tax refund program and renters refund program. So What this does is that right now, if you are a claimant, you get a personal exemption when calculating your income for purposes of these property tax refund programs. So the income is, of course, the starting point, and you had a chart like this. What this bill would do is that if your spouse is 65 and older or disabled, you would get another personal exemption, which would be equal to $4,050 is the federal exemption. So basically what this does, if you're 65 or disabled, you would be able to lower your starting income by $4,050. And, of course, that then triggers the threshold of, you know, what percent of your income you have to pay, what is your copay, and what is your maximum. So that is what the bill does, and I'll be open to any questions.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Anyone that would like to testify on the bill? Ms. Madden, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. Just appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1930 and thank Representative Marquardt for bringing this proposal forward. As Representative Marquardt described, that this is a bill that at a relatively modest cost to the state fixes a marriage penalty that exists in our state's property tax refund that hits some of Minnesota seniors and people with disabilities. We think this is a good adjustment to the property tax refunds, and it's a good fit along with the existing provisions that adjust for family size. I also just wanted to briefly thank Representative Pryor, and you also have a bill from Representative Loeffler coming as well on the property tax refund for putting some additional ideas on the table in relation to that refund, and especially appreciate the provisions in those bills that are focused on modest-income homeowners and renters. The property tax refund is the state's income-targeted tool that puts a limit on how much of their incomes Minnesotans can pay in property taxes. It recognizes that both homeowners and renters pay property taxes, although they do it in different ways. And all three of these bills to expand the property tax refund kind of make their changes under the hood, you know, kind of behind the scenes in ways that don't create any additional barriers to taxpayers or change the very familiar process for applying for this refund. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Members, questions for Ms. Madden or the author? Okay, Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt, this is for both renters and homestead.
Representative Marquardt.
Chair, Representative Erickson, that's correct.
Representative Erickson.
So then on the renters, that would be a set percentage, correct?
Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I don't quite understand what you're saying on a set percentage. What we'll do is, where you're starting point with the income, it would lower it by $4,050 because you'd have an extra personal exemption that would you'd be able to subtract off of your income.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Marquardt, anything?
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I mean, this is an excellent way to target property tax relief to senior citizens and those folks with disability. It's about $9.2 million of targeted property tax relief. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, Representative Marquardt renews his motion. House File 1930 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Loeffler. Representative Loeffler moves that her bill, House File 2182, be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. She also has an A1 amendment. Would you like to move, Representative Loeffler?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd love to move the A1 amendment. What it does is just update for the February forecast factors, and I appreciate the work of our staff to always keep us on top of these changes that happen after we get bills drafted.
Thank you. Discussion on A1 amendment, members. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. A1 is adopted. Representative Wofford.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This, again, is another bill to increase the homestead credit, or what I still sometimes refer to as the property tax credit refund, and the homeowners and the renter's credit. And I always feel that in our approach to dealing with the property tax burdens across the state, that we have a variety of tools and we ought to use all of them. And this week we heard proposals to significantly increase our investment in local government aid and county program aid to help our local governments to keep their tax burdens manageable. We've heard a variety of bills to adjust and problem solve on issues that have arisen in the agricultural property and other areas. And I think another key part of our toolkit is our direct targeted tax relief to those people whose home, many of whom are seniors or disabled or of modest income, who struggle to keep up with property taxes. And if you recall Monday's hearing, we heard from people across the state about the shortage of both workforce and affordable housing and how our housing markets in many communities are in turmoil and shifting rapidly, just as somewhat the agricultural values have been shifting as well. The homestead, this one is a little richer than Representative Pryor's. Her's total cost was about $25 million, and this is about $50, which I think is a reasonable estimate for in balance with the other three factors that I said that we've been considering in committee. And it would increase both the maximum at all incomes at a the maximum would go about 10%, which we have not adjusted this since 2013. And if you think of the property tax increases since 2013, you know, that's about 2.5% a year. So it just kind of keeps us moving with what people have been experiencing. And the homestead credit part of the refund, the average statewide would be an increase of $421 with about 55,000 taxpayers benefiting. It would benefit, you know, people throughout the state. The renter's credit has both, again, an adjustment for the maximum as well as the income brackets. It also does increase the maximum income that you would qualify for. The maximum income for homeowners is $110,000 for renters. I'm proposing that it go to $75,000. We've heard on the floor that in some parts of the state, the average rent for a one-bedroom is $600, $700 a month. And unfortunately, in other areas where there's a real rental shortage, whether that's a college town, a place with a growing employment like we heard from on Monday, or in the metropolitan area, we've seen tech renting with averages of $1,300 to $1,500, particularly in some of the suburbs. And to qualify for those apartments, you have to generally have take-home pay three times your rent. So if you had two recent college graduates, I just heard yesterday, a beginning social worker starts at $36,000. So if you had a married couple or both social workers just met in college, have college loans, to get just that average apartment, they're going to have to earn that much. Going up to this maximum, they'd still only get a $200 recognition, but in their community, they're still scrapping by. The average increase for renters statewide would be $312, so about 25% less than what is targeted here for homeowners. And with that, I'd be glad to answer questions. Tried to balance this out geographically as well as in terms of the various market forces that are being experienced. And yet this will continue to have the program targeted at those lowest income homeowners and renters who are disproportionately seniors and people with disabilities in most communities.
Thank you, Representative Wofford. Anyone else who would like to anyone who would like to testify on the bill? Questions, members? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rafa, I don't know if this would be for you or staff, but just taking a look at the cost of this bill against Representative Pryor's bill, I certainly understand why the cost would be higher on this bill for the renter credit part. But for the homestead credit part, it looks like the parameters are roughly the same, but the cost is about $4.4 million higher under this proposal. Just kind of wondering what would go into that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
And Representative Lean, there are also differences in the threshold percentages. As you get into those what might seem as upper middle class incomes in greater Minnesota and are really considered kind of middle class or lower middle class incomes in the metro. One of the things that I had asked Ms. Manzi in looking at this to try and address is right now, if you've ever looked at the BOSS report, which is the Department of Revenue's analysis of property tax burdens by income, that in the metro area, that after the refund, the homestead credit refund, the metro is average property tax burden is 2.6% of income. And in greater Minnesota, it's 2.0% of income. This won't make a major shift in that, but it will start to bring those a little bit closer. We can't change the economies of our different parts of the state, but I think our goal should be that if people with similar sorts of housing and incomes have similar sort of burdens, and right now there's a significant difference right now between metro and greater Minnesota, and this just tilts it a little bit towards that. Those incomes around $80,000 to
$100,000. Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think I see now. It looks like the max refund for the higher income levels would be $10 more under this. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Thank you,
Representative Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know the amounts here. Would you divide them by? You know, the two property tax payments checks you have to write out if you're a homeowner or the monthly rent that you pay. It isn't that much, but for people at these income scales, it really makes a difference.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? We did ask everyone who wanted to testify. With that, Representative Loeffler renews her motion. The House File 2182 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson moves that his bill, House File 1379, be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson. And Representative Anderson also moves adoption of the A17-0223 amendment. Discussion on the amendment.
It is, Mr. Chair, kind of a cleanup amendment. We met yesterday and had a couple of changes to make, but they're in the amendment and agreement by all that they worked on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting A17-0223 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And one other oral amendment, again, after discussion, this has kind of been a work in progress. And I'd like to offer an oral amendment to delete Section 7, and that would be lines 5, 12 through 4. Line 520.
Okay. Representative Anderson moves an oral amendment to strike Section 7 from the bill, striking lines 5.12 through 5.20. Is that correct, Representative Anderson?
That's correct.
A discussion on the amendment. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did have a chance to meet with the people who have been working on this bill, and they gave me a situation in which tax forfeited. They acquired a business that was having some real problems complying with its licenses and things, and by deleting this, does that mean that they can never do it or that there's a different process that they can use? Do you know, Representative Anderson?
Chair Anderson.
We're talking about Section 7 again, the part?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, we have to work on it further. There is some concern about if a tenant were paying their rent in the building is tax forfeited. Didn't seem fair to you know, have the business shut down. So we haven't reached agreement on that yet. We're still going to try to work on it, but as of now, we haven't come to that conclusion yet.
Representative Walker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a lot of good problem solving on this one, and I trust that Representative Anderson will continue to problem solve on this. The problem is when a county sort of inherits a problem business and assumes then, of course, liability for what's going on in that business and how to work that out. And I'm comfortable that smart people come up with a resolution.
Thank you. Other questions on the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of Chair Anderson's oral amendment to strike Section 7 through the bill, striking lines 5.12 through 5.20, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The oral amendment is adopted. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The background of this bill, MACO, and I discussed this a year ago at end of session and didn't quite have enough time to come to any conclusions. So in the past year, MACO, working within its organization that has been working on this bill and trying to come up with things that work, refining these proposals within their organization, and what we've ended up here with is a series of 15 provisions that will streamline and improve the process related to tax forfeiture properties. And the goal of that is returning parcels to the tax rolls more quickly, and also to save taxpayer dollars and to make some technical changes and updates, which I have some help here to explain those for you, committee. I have Jeff Strand, I believe, and Cindy Geis would be able to discuss the nuances of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mr. Strand first or Ms. Geis? Ms. Geis.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cindy Geis. I'm the Auditor-Treasurer for Scott County. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which is MACO. Our organization is encompassed by auditor-treasurers, recorders, and financial officers. This bill has been something that, of course, it is near and dear to our hearts, and it has been really vested. A lot of people have vested a lot of time into this bill for quite a few hours over a couple of years. But ultimately, when we look at delinquency and forfeiture, that is probably one of the most difficult processes that we have to do within our organization when it comes to dealing with property taxes. As we know, nobody likes to receive some of those friendly reminder or ugly notices saying, hey, by the way, you didn't pay your taxes. And if, by the way, you don't pay your taxes within a certain period of time, we're going to take your property. And then the aftermath of if we take the property, what happens? And so we, as a government, are always looking for how do we do things so that we make sure that everybody's treated fairly and equitably, that nobody is harmed by the things that we do. And by harmed, I mean it's not only the person that may lose their property, and there may be many different reasons for that, but what about the people who are next to these properties or the communities who inherit some of these problems that come along with tax forfeited lands? So we as counties are trying to say, how do we get a little bit ahead of the game and try to make sure that there isn't some other type of financial burden that these taxpayers and citizens of that area have to pay through some other form, most likely property taxes. We want to make sure that these provisions are clear, and they're consistent, and that everybody is administering them in the same way. There are problems with some of the languages that exist out there. Like we always find, we come across some of these obsolete provisions. So let's get those out of the statute so that no one else tries to tag on to those obsolete provisions. And bottom line, we really just really want to protect the people's property rights. And that means whether they're the people who are affected or maybe they're not the people who are affected, they are the ones that are living next door to it. I guess there's an impact, but it's not direct. As to the question that Representative Loeffler had on what if we inherit these businesses that now we're landlords and what do we do with them, there are always other types of provisions that have been in existence for a long time, and that is the eviction process. I will tell you a situation in Scott County. We had a community center forfeit, and we forfeited in May. And when the county inherited it, we were like, oh, my gosh. Every weekend from May until October, there were events scheduled in there. And it was weddings and anniversaries and birthday parties and all these other types of social events. And in that, we, of course, are going, we have major liability here. There's food coming forward. There's a lot of people who are going on this property. There are people who are going to be serving liquor. And what is the county going to do with that? And so we work with property owners to try to say, okay, or not property owners in that case, but we were saying, what can we do as a landlord, which we don't want to be, to try to make sure that even the people who are holding events aren't harmed. We were lucky enough to work. We were working with someone to say, hey, you know what? They're gonna take on continuing to manage these events. They're going to lease from us. They're going to get liability insurance. We're going to make sure through the legal realm that all of our liability is really limited. So there are things that we can do, and that is through eviction, the 30-day notice, or whatever it takes to say, you know, we're not going to be a landlord. We don't want to put our county at risk, and no counties want to do that. So with that, I will stand for questions and pass it on to Mr. Strand.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. Mr. Strand.
Chair Drozdowski and committee members, I'm Jeffrey Strand, administrative manager with Hennepin County Resident Real Estate Services Department, responsible for delinquent property tax enforcement and collections, tax forfeit property administration, and tax processing. I am testifying tonight on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Officers, MACO, as the lead co-chair of the County Auditor Treasurer Finance Officer Statewide Delinquency and Tax Forfeiture Committee. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this proposal forward. I'd like to supplement Cindy Geis's testimony to provide brief context for the sections in this House File 1379. The McCaffrey Committee has representation of county auditors and treasurers from across Minnesota, from at least 20 counties, from Roseau to Wabasha, from Lyon to St. Louis, metro, suburban, and rural, along with the Department of Revenue. I'm honored to co-chair the committee with Heather Bessler, Olmsted County, as the second lead co-chair. And by the way, Heather and I served as instructors at two 2016 Revenue Department Auditor Treasurer training sessions in order to educate our peers and make sure that the practices are consistent across the counties in Minnesota. The committee solicited, evaluated, and revised legislative proposals as part of its charge from the McCaffrey Board. This work has been carried on since December 2015 through February 2017, with recommendations reviewed and approved at committee meetings and recommendations given to the MACO Legislative Committee. And then the items appeared in the 2016 and 2017 MACO platform documents, and we had the pleasure of meeting with the chair last year to review some of the sections that are similar again this year. In conclusion, we believe the proposals will increase efficiency and effectiveness in this area, helping to provide greater value to our residents and taxpayers. The provisions we believe will produce better outcomes for our communities, help eliminate blight from abandoned properties, and give greater flexibility to return tax forfeit properties to productive reuse more quickly. As one Central Minnesota Auditor Treasurer commented to me, quote, ultimately, this helps counties manage this difficult process and saves taxpayers money. Thank you for allowing us to testify. We ask for your support and stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. Anyone else would like to testify on House File 1379? Mr. Elwood, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I just want to thank Representative Anderson and the Hennepin County folks. Several of these amendments are a result of the discussions that we had. And I know that in the conversations we had, Representative Anderson probably learned more about landlord-tenant law than he ever wished to know. And I really just wanted to say, express our appreciation to the author and the folks from Hennepin County for working with us to get it where it is. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Mr. Hill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Restaurant Association, the service stations and convenience stores, and also pitching in for Brian Carr at the Retailers Association. We just wanted to thank Representative Anderson for striking Section 7. It was our organizations today that raised some concern with that, and we appreciate the county's willingness to continue to look at that section. But we do have some concerns if we have members that are tenants in a building that is then forfeited Under this language, we have some concern what would happen to those businesses and how they would be treated, and we'll continue to work with the author and the parties to try to come up with a better approach.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Anyone else would like to testify? House File 1379. Questions, members? Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson.
I think it's all been said, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Anderson renews his motion. House File 1379 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Rarick, do you want to do your bill? House File 1263. Representative Rarick moves that his bill, House File 1263, be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1263 is a bill that I've brought forward trying to help address an issue in my area and a couple areas in the state. Basically, what the bill will do is on your property tax statement, it would add in soil and watershed districts as a separate line item like other special taxing districts. A little bit of the issue, having served on Environment Natural Resources last time around, I see firsthand, you know, just how much the state is asking of our soil and watershed districts to do. That job is ever increasing. We saw it with the buffer stuff that came along last time. And unfortunately, we do have some counties that have not been doing a very good job of funding their soil and watershed districts. I believe this would help them out to be able to show and be able to explain to the residents of that county if there is an increase, where it's going, and why they need to do it. And we have several soil and watershed board members and some a representative from the counties as well that I think can better explain why we're here.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Who would like to testify for or against House File 1263? Is Ms. Burkholm here? Mr. Swain? Mr. Thompson?
Hello.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Tom Swain. I'm one of the SWCD supervisors in Pine County.
Thank you, Tom. Mr. Swain, please proceed, Mr. Swain.
Okay. Chairman and members, glad that I was able to talk to you. I appreciate the opportunity. The language, as you know, was included in last year's bill, so a lot of the groundwork has already been done. We understand on an ongoing basis that the state is requiring us to do more and more to interface with the private landowners in our counties. The state has stepped up and provided us with some capacity funding that is greatly appreciated, and now we would like to have a way to force some of our county residents to support us. At this point, we're going through the county commissioners, and they haven't seen fit to help us a lot. So we would like to increase that support from them, and I think this bill is an excellent way of doing that. Thank you for the opportunity. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Swain. Any questions for Mr. Swain? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Swain. Anyone else would like to testify on this bill? Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, Mark Delwitt, the supervisor from Carlton County. Thank you all for staying up late with us and the staff that's working a little overtime tonight. Thank you all. Our county, Carlton County, is probably one of the Gold Star counties with funding from the county. So this language that's here is another tool in their toolbox to be able to go outside of their budgets when times get tough. The soil and water districts are pretty much classified as a department of the county for funding. And by being able to put us in the special tax district class, they can mediate some of the other issues in the county by putting us over there, funding us through that mechanism. In Carleton County, that amount of money that the county gives us for funding our base operations is about $6 on a $150,000 house. We get a lot done with that $6. That allows us to do matching work. All of the Bowser funds that we receive, we have to match, which emphasizes for our county, we can do that work. Another tool that's very important to us, and that's why I want to thank you a whole bunch, is keeping the Minnesota Conservation Corps working. They're a real tool for us. These young people come out of school. You give them a job in the summer. They work for us. We can get projects on the ground in the back areas of the county. That's just been a terrific aid for us. And there's so many other partnerships. The other thing that you do well with us is you fund our technical services area. In 2012, Carleton County was hit drastically with flooding. Our projects that were put in place using that engineering services, there was minimum damage. So the money that comes through from the county and the state has a real revenue generator down the world that we are protecting our hills that face down into Lake Spear because a lot of the drainage goes down there. We have been tracking. We're working diligently to come up and match the One Watershed, One Plan. And this bill, hopefully, some of the counties that do not fund, again, I call Carleton County a Gold Star County because they do fund us well. We work with our county commissioners. We're there. But we do have a whole bunch of counties around us in northeast Minnesota that do not come up to the plate. And this is an opportunity for them by using the special tax district to take some of the emphasis off their own budgets where they're weak at. And, yes, it's still taxes, but this is no new tax to anybody. The counties that are doing it, the residents are already paying it, so it's a good deal. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Thell. Questions for Mr. Thell? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anyone else would like to testify? Please introduce yourself.
Skip Thompson, Pine County Soil and Water Chairman. I want to thank the chair and the member committees for hearing this bill. I'd like to ask for your support for Pine County. We could use all the help we can get up there. You've been to Pine County.
From Mille Lacs.
There you go. So I don't want to get into all the details. We do appreciate the additional funding that the state has given us. We would like the county and our local people to help us a little bit further along with less strings attached to the money so it's easier for us to conduct our day-to-day business and protect the soil and the water and keep it in place. With that, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Members, questions for Mr. Thompson? Okay, thank you. Mr. Hilgard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgart. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm filling in for Jennifer Berkwan this evening. She was not able to make it. I just wanted to start by acknowledging the great work that SWCDs do in our local communities and the vast amount of, or the large percentage of our partnerships that are good, stable, strong, and that we have great projects that we work with them on. The two concerns that we have from our association, again, the first one is the overarching approach that this bill takes. Basically, you've heard some issues about a certain region of the state and the relationships between the county and the SWCDs. I think from AMC's perspective, this is a pretty overarching solution to a local issue, which we hope to work through. And second, which is kind of our larger concern, at least from the association's perspective, is that this potentially could be a conduit or a road for levy authority down the road. And that is something that our membership has discussed. It was noted that we did not necessarily have a position on this last year. You did not see us at the table when this provision was included in the tax bill, and that's because we were taking and doing our due diligence of talking amongst our membership of, is this the right thing? Are we okay with this? And we were divided as well, but the majority of our folks do not think this is necessary. and are hopeful that we can try to accommodate some of the concerns raised today without this legislation or going down the road of potentially giving a new organization levying authority, which if that is a conversation this committee wants to have, we would just ask that AMC be included in it. I do want to leave the committee and folks and Representative Rarick with an offer that I've talked to people before the meeting with, and that is that AMC would be happy to host a conversation between the aggrieved SWCDs and the counties where they are the host. And I think part of this confusion, at least from what I've heard the last few weeks on this issue, stems from it's not always as easy as, you know, we need more money and why aren't you giving it to us. It's the counties that were named today are dealing with child protection costs. They are short on child protection workers. They are dealing with huge tax shifts already in their base. They're dealing with county attorney's offices who are requesting more and more staff and they're unable to get it. Sheriff's office requesting things as well. And a reduction in county program aid, which this committee heard just recently earlier this week. So there are a lot of elements that go into budgeting. And while the work that SWCDs do is invaluable, we have to also consider that as county commissioners on a plate of full options that we have in front of us. And the second thing which I think AMC looks forward to working with our members on is clearing up some confusion on perhaps the projects that SWCDs do. And we would be very happy to work with all these parties to make sure that county commissioners are also equally aware of the work that SWCDs do so that in their budgeting process it becomes more of ability to say, oh, yeah, we know this because of the project that was completed down the road at so-and-so's house. So, again, I just want to leave members with that opportunity that no matter where this bill goes today, AMC would be happy to host that discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Questions for Mr. Hilgart? Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is for Mr. Hilgart, but maybe this is for staff. Are all special taxing districts have the authority to levy taxes on their own? I mean, under 275.066, it lists, you know, all of these special taxing districts, starting with watershed districts. And I know they have the authority to levy on their own, but is that what a special taxing district is? Is someone that, like a mosquito control? I don't know who, Mr. Hines or Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, I guess, you know, certainly true that most of these do have independent levy authority. I'm not sure whether I can say that they all do or not. And but
that's fine. Mr. Chair, and I don't know if Representative Rarick here. I mean, I'm not quite understanding what we're doing here. It sounds like we're not giving soil and water conservation districts a levying authority,
that's right.
But we are creating another line item on
the tax
statement. And if you have a lake improvement district, you have that. And they're able to, a lake improvement district, they have an elected group in the lake improvement, and then they will levy, but it has to be approved by the county, but it does show up on the property tax statement. But I'm not quite understanding this. You're setting them up like a special taxing district. Does that mean they come to you with a recommendation of what they would like, or how is this? I'm not quite sure how this is working, quite frankly.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt. Right now, you know, the Soil and Watershed Boards are elected boards.
Yep.
And they turn in a request to the county board for the funding that they feel they need to do the job that they're doing. Many counties in the state are giving them the budget that they request. There are some that are not. And at this time, you know, the Soil and Watershed Districts have no real recourse. They just have to live with what the county board's decision is. The purpose behind this, to be able to show them as a line item on the property tax statement, just like you said with the lake groups, mm-hmm. is that you know, it was explained that our counties have all these other areas that they have to fund. As an elected board, by listing it as a separate line item, if people have an issue within the county of, well, why are my taxes going up? The county board would more easily be able to point to this is the area that went up, and then those concerns could then be addressed to the elected board that was responsible for it. So I believe this will aid our counties in showing, you know, doing the work that, or, you know, allowing the soil and watershed districts to do the work that they need to do while helping kind of alleviate their levy, you know, what their levy looks like, you know. So this, it kind of pulls it out so people would, if they have to increase for something or make a cut, it just makes it more transparent to the people, and so they'd be more accepting of, say, an increase because there's, you know, people want to protect the water, and so I think we believe that the people would be accepting of that far better than just the county saying, oh, we have to raise the levy.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Rick, thank you. That was very helpful. So it sounds like some counties are not providing an adequate budget. How does this help those soil and water conservation districts kind of alleviate that problem?
Representative Rick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt. I believe, you know, for the counties that do need to make that increase, by doing this, they can, like it was stated, that, you know, a house, $150,000 house in that area, the soil and watershed district, it would be a $6 a tax. So this way the county could approve the budget of the SWCD, and each person would maybe see that $2-3 increase on that line instead of, and then people would see that, okay, the soil and watershed district got an additional $40,000 or whatever that number would be, as opposed to the county having to say we're increasing our levy.
All right.
Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, yeah, okay. I understand that now. Thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rarick, here in the metro, sometimes we have watershed districts that are organized as water management organizations, and oftentimes the watershed districts cross municipal jurisdictions. I was just wondering if the soil and water conservation districts also might be organized in such a manner that they cross county lines.
Representative Rarick?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I was just told no.
Okay.
I think that's correct. Representative Hertaus.
And that would be good because certainly that would add complexity to it. And I just view this as kind of a disclosure to the taxpayer as to how much of their county budget is being expended towards the district. And in the previous case that I was describing with multiple cities, if we were required to do that, it would be hard to for the taxpayer to understand how much they're getting because each city would disclose their portion. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barrick, what I'm struggling with is, correct me if I didn't catch this correctly, the soil and water boards make a recommendation for their funding to the county board, correct? But yet it's then, so they're not setting their own budget. It's determined by the county commissioners, correct?
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, what happens is the soil and watershed district is looking at what they're being tasked to do, and they will look at, well, what do we need in our budget to accomplish this for staffing, administrative costs, and such. So they bring that to the county board, and in, I believe, most cases around the state, the county board makes that approval. In some, they look at that and they say, well, we can't fit that into our levy, and they cut them. And then those soil and watershed districts have to figure out how they are going to accomplish what they're supposed to do with that funding that doesn't meet. I know in the case of Pine County, my home county, they do not have one full-time staff person. They are not able to pay them the wage that they really should be, and do they have any benefit? Okay. And after the state's help now with this one, they were finally able to offer some benefit packages to those people. So, you know, that's basically what we're looking at with this, is for them to be able to staff to the level that they need to. And in turn, that, you know, if they're staffed the way they need to, then they can go and write the grants that they need to write to get some of that other matching funds. You know, the ones who aren't getting that staffing, the funding for the staff fall behind in all the other areas.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. I get all that, and I appreciate you stating that again. But what I guess concerns me then is calling this out as a line item on their tax statement, and for the transparency, but that responsibility in terms of what was set was not on the part of the watershed, but actually on the part of the county. So if they're trying to direct attention towards accountability for setting that price, it seems it's a little bit misleading in saying, hey, this is what was imposed by the watershed, when in fact it was imposed by the county themselves. So letting the county off the hook, just, you know, see what I'm saying? It seems like we're misdirecting them towards the agency, which made a recommendation, but ultimately didn't make the decision as to what was going to be charged.
Representative Eric?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I could see where you're going with that. Ultimately, having spoken with the SWCD board members here that are here, they are more than willing to be the one, and they understand, you're right, it still has to be approved by the county board, and right. It still shows on your total amount to the county. But I think the Solon Watershed Districts are more than willing to respond to people as to why they are asking for the funding that they are. Yes. And so I believe that will help our county boards be willing to approve the budget that they ask for, knowing that, yes, they'll still probably get some calls, but the Solon Watershed boards will then also have it be shown, and they will be able to help answer why that funding was needed.
Yeah. Representative Carlson.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barrick, can you explain a little bit why having the levy certified separately? Is that something other special taxing districts do, where they certify it separately?
Representative Barrick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, I'm not...
Mr. Hines, the certification of special taxing districts.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, the special taxing districts are able to certify a levy themselves. That's kind of the difference we're talking about here. So in general, the special districts actually certify to the county what their levy is, but the county doesn't approve it. It just levies it. So this is a different situation from other special districts.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hines, so then the county is going to have to certify the special taxing district separately then.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, under this proposal, yes, the county would separately, would basically kind of certify its general levy and then it's the levy for the Soil and Water Conservation District.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm just wondering why that mechanism, since it's more unusual.
Representative Rick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, I guess I don't know 100% how to answer that question. This was the route, as I spoke to people to try to figure out how to do it, that I was recommended. I am willing to meet with Mr. Hilgert and the counties. If we can take care of this, I would love it to happen that way. This is an issue that's been going on for years in my county. So I am hoping that this can move forward, but if there are some corrections that can be made to it, I am willing to look at that.
Representative Joaquin?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Heldergart may have an answer for me, but one concern I have with doing it this way is that maybe the Soil and Water District may end up not getting as much as they would have because the county is having to certify it separately. So maybe you should, take that into consideration, too. I'm worried it's going to go the opposite way.
Mr. Heldergart?
Representative Drazkowski, Representative Joaquin, I think I want to make two points. One, that we're focusing on a couple of instances right now. But I want to reassure members, and I hope you'll hear from upcoming testimony too, that the vast majority of our partnerships of SWCDs and counties go very well. And they're strong partnerships, and they're doing great work. So I think the goal here, at least from AMC's perspective, is maybe not this venue for change or seeking change, but to try to figure this out in our communities. And as I mentioned, AMC has taken, we're on record saying that we are interested in trying to pursue actual conversations between these parties to try to figure out how we can open this communication and make things work a little bit better. And I think it's going to be a give and take between the county and perhaps opening up some more funding resources, but also some accountability, and let's see what the projects are. Let's have perhaps proposals, grant proposals, and let's actually see and have a professional way of making sure that the projects that are being funded, that it's transparent and that we have something to hold up at the end of the day and say, look at this. This is what's been happening.
Representative Yorkey. I don't know if I asked before, but has everyone who wanted to testify on this bill testified? They have not. Representative, before you testify, sir, Representative Anderson has a question.
I can wait.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'm Roland Cleveland, and members. I'm an elected Soil and Water Conservation District Board member from Chisago SWCD, and I also serve on our State Association Board as a metro area representative, and I'm currently the vice president of our state association. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. We appreciate Representative Rarick bringing this issue forward. There's a lot of confusion about what this bill is and isn't within our own members, and it is not tax and authority. And although, you know, we support in our platform the language of this bill to bring greater transparency and public awareness, because that's all this does. It does not ensure any more funding for SWCDs. We look at it as people being aware when you see their tax statement that the county spends money on Soil and Water Conservation District. And we just want to make them aware of, in some cases, sometimes it's how little it is, sometimes it's how much it is. For the average person looking at it, they have nothing to compare it to, so they don't know if that's good or bad. We find ourselves in a little difficult position here because this is part of our platform. But we believe, because of the confusion here about what this bill does or doesn't do, we believe that we need to work with our county partners and work with building a long-term relationship and working on a host of issues. We're dealing with, you know, buffer laws with the county. We're dealing with one watershed, one plan, and comprehensive water planning, and many other issues. We would actually prefer to have a longer, fuller conversation with AMC on these issues, including this. And like I say, we have confusion within our own membership about what this bill does or doesn't do. Everybody goes like, well, is this tax and authority, or is this what is it? And we do not want this little issue, you know, it's a small step for awareness, but seeing how AMC has chosen to oppose it, we don't want this issue to jeopardize our work with our partners in trying to make a short-term solution to what is a long-term problem, and we feel it wouldn't be prudent to move this forward at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Cleveland. Questions for Mr. Cleveland, members? Anyone else who would like to testify on this bill?
I could have one little clarification. One thing that gets confused here is we are a special unit of government. We are not a special taxing district. We do not have taxing authority. It's a different title. We do have to go beg for our money and hope to get it. And the point was made here today, it's from one area, and it's not a majority of our state, but it's not just one area. There's outliers in all areas of the state that could do a better job of funding their SWCDs. We just happen to have the people are here testifying today are from one particular area, and one reason they're here is they're not that terrible far away, and they do have some issues that do need addressing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cleveland. Any other questions, members, for testifiers or the author? Okay. Hearing none, Representative Rarick. Oh, excuse me. Oh, Representative Anderson, I forgot. Sorry, sir.
Sorry. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I had to step out for a minute, so if this has been discussed, somebody tell me to stop. But anyway, I understand where you're going with this, and I think it's fine. My only concern is when the county has to do this as a levy, then I would assume the SWCD has to follow that same timeline for truth and taxation and then finalizing the levy at the end of December. And if they might go on different fiscal years, for example, I just would want to make that clarification that you're both on the same page in terms of when you
decide how much money you need, and that the county, if they are going to levy for it, will have to go through that series of truth and taxation and finalizing their levy.
This bill does not go that far. It's not giving us levy authority.
Mr. Cleveland, yes.
We just go ask the county in July, usually, or June, July. Every county is different, June, July, August. We ask them that we would like you to give us $80,000, and it either gets either to give us 80 or 50 or 30 or 100, and that just isn't part of their general thing that goes from the truth of taxation hearing. We do not show up at a truth and taxation because we do not levy ourselves.
Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, but my only point was if the county has to give you that money as a separate levy, I don't care, you know, how much it is or when it is, but they have to follow their timeline for truth and taxation in finalizing their levy. So if you're saying you want your money in June or July, well, you'd be ready to tell them the previous December how much you need if they have to follow their levy requirements. Not talking about you levying, yeah, but the county levying.
No, we tell them in June or July, or, you know, even sometimes in May in some counties, what we need for the next year, and that's what they levy. They do usually a preliminary levy in the end of August, early September, and then they do a final truth and taxation levy in December.
Representative Anderson? Representative Hertaus?
Thank you. I yield. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. With that, Representative Rarick renews his motion in the House File 1263 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Rarick. And testifiers.
Chair Drazkowski moves his House File 2186 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2186 is a bill that right-sizes the renter's refund, renter's property tax refund. I think you have in your packets from the department a note that outlines not only the impact of the bill, but also in its analysis presents a discussion about what the actual percentage of rent in calculation for the renter's credit property tax refund is. Members, right now in statute it says and by the way, members and Mr. Chair, I'm one in the past, and I still believe this, that this really isn't, that the renters don't actually pay the property tax. Now, our culture believes differently, and so I understand that. Given that, my belief is that if we do have that belief as a culture, then we should actually base our renter's credit on the actual percent of property tax paid. Now, in statute, it says 17%. It's a fixed percentage that is used in the calculation. The U.S. Census, the most recent data from 2015, says that statewide that's actually 14.5%. And you can see kind of the regional breakouts there that the census data offers us. Mr. Chair and members, this bill is actually written to in a form that goes back to the way it was before we had a fixed percentage. And I don't know, maybe one of the staff members, maybe Ms. Manzi could tell us the history on it. But at one point in time, the landlords had to actually calculate the actual amount for their particular facilities and their renters, and include that in their certificate of rent paid that they send in. So this bill is actually tailored around that. The authors desired, as is, if this bill should move forward, is not necessarily to go that approach.
I know I've talked to some landlords, and they are they have a very difficult time with this. It adds a lot more work on their end, and I think it actually adds more work on the department's end too, to go this way. But I want to have a discussion with the committee here tonight on what might be the best approach and what actually what data is available. We know we have the census data available. Is there any better data that the department might have for us to most accurately right-size the percentage that is offered in this calculation moving forward? So that's the idea behind the bill here, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Daskowski. Would you like to invite discussion from members first, or do you want to let people testify?
Your call, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, I see we have a few people on the testifying list. Would any of you like to come forward? Looks like Mr. Elwood is. Please state your name and who you are representing for the record, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. You know, it's always a thrill to come up and testify against the chair's bill. So, but nonetheless, here we are. And I know we've had this discussion for many years, so probably Representative Truskowski could probably give my testimony tonight. But obviously, you know, many of our legal aid clients are recipients of the renter's credit. And what we do know for sure is that when they do get the credit, they return that money directly and very quickly into the local economy, paying rent, utilities, paying for groceries, school supplies, shoes for their children. These are all things that are, that renters have testified to in years past. And one thing we also know is that rents have gone up significantly since 2009, 1% in the metro, but even higher in greater Minnesota, 18% in northwest and central Minnesota. And the reality is this is, of course, a tax increase on renters, and that really makes it rough for those folks at this time. And as Representative Chair Jaskowski did mention, and he acknowledged the complicated methodology that this the bill at this point sets up, and clearly he's looking to perhaps modify that. But, you know, in closing, just the percentage that was fixed at an amount had been done as a compromise agreement years ago. It's the only credit that renters get. It's the only tax reduction that renters get. And it was done in an effort to create a tax fairness across the board. So we would hope that we could maintain this and help renters as we are helping others in the tax bill this year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Mr. Elwood, I thought I heard you say that you thought this might increase property taxes, but I don't think that's what the discussion is about. It's just about disclosing how much of your rent is paid to property taxes. In some ways, I would think that that would give a greater sense of value to the tenant in understanding what they're paying for the actual rent of the building versus the taxes they're paying as part of that rent. Might even cause some concern that renters might even show up at a city council meeting fully understanding how much of their rent is being paid for something. So what are your thoughts on that position that I'm stating?
Well, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the amount that the renters would receive would be reduced by a certain, you know, the percentage is now 17%, and Representative Jaskowski is talking about a lower percentage, and that would then redound to a smaller credit. So that was my understanding of the impact of this, and that's what I was addressing. Certainly a disclosure to tenants and folks about the amounts and the amount of property tax that the landlord is paying, is no one would, I don't think, would have any concern about disclosing that information to consumers or renters.
Thank you. And I guess in high-rent areas, the property tax might even be 18% or 19%, so it might work to the benefit of some in that regard. Any other questions of Mr. Elwood? Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Next, I think we have Nan. Would you state your name and who you represent for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Nan Madden, Director of the Minnesota Budget Project.
Welcome, Ms. Madden, to the committee.
I do also have a handout for the committee, if that's okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Has that been distributed?
So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify with some concerns about the impact of House File 2186. The fiscal note does not have specific information about the number of Minnesotans who would be winners or losers under this bill. Minnesota's lower-income renters collectively would lose more than $41 million a year in tax refunds, and that represents an 18% cut to the renter's credit overall. The renter's credit, like the circuit breaker for homeowners, is an effective policy tool to limit how big of a share of a household's budget can go towards paying property taxes. And it has important advantages over other mechanisms to bring down property taxes in that it is targeted by income and it doesn't shift property taxes onto other property taxpayers. The renter's credit is targeted to low and moderate income Minnesotans whose property taxes, which they pay through their rents, are high in relation to their incomes. About 70% of the households that receive the renter's credit have household incomes roughly $31,000 or less. 27% of the households that receive the renter's credit include seniors or people with disabilities. And in Greater Minnesota, that percentage tends to be higher, and in some counties, considerably higher. And the handout that I provided to the committee provides more information about the benefits of the renter's credit in each county across the state. In a time of state budget surpluses, we are concerned that this bill would cut tax refunds and thereby raise taxes on those Minnesotans least able to make up the difference. There's no question that on the macro level, the renter's credit is effective in meeting its goal. Without the renter's credit, rental property taxes are among the most regressive taxes in the state. I think one thing that the earlier bills on the property tax refund really illustrated to you is that the percentage of rent is just one part of the number of policy choices that you all get to make about the calculations for the renter's credit. It also takes into account the household's income, the family size, whether there's a senior or a person with disabilities in the home, how high the property taxes are in relation to their income, and how much of the excess property taxes the state has chosen to refund. So those are all policy choices that are available to you. I appreciate Chair Drazkowski's openness to avoiding changes in the credit that would create additional administrative challenges. But we do think that it is important if this committee looks at any changes to the percentage of rent part of the renter's credit that you look at some corresponding changes to other parts of the proposal as well, perhaps to make it revenue neutral or otherwise limit the damaging effect that it would have on Minnesotans' low-income renters. And I just wanted to make one point on the census data. I do appreciate that the Department of Revenue is doing their best to provide some information on this. But that 2015 data, if you're going to use that to project the calculations for renter's credit in fiscal 2019, that's quite a bit of a data lag. And again, that isn't data that is directly relevant to the specific families who receive the renter's credit, but is a more of a statewide figure. I mean, it might be the best that is available, but it's not kind of quite spot on for this population. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Members, questions of Ms. Madden? If not, we have another testifier, Mr. Lillianquist.
Yes.
Would you state your name and who you represent for? The record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Todd Lillianquist with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, Trade Association for Rental Property Owners and Managers and Developers.
Welcome to the committee this evening.
Thank you. I'm here to speak as to the current status of the bill and the bill as introduced, not perhaps as much to what the bill may be in the committee's discussion after this, but as Chair Drazkowski indicated, we do have some concerns about the complexity that would be added if a formula would need to be calculated and it would go back to the old way. A number of our member companies use national software, which Minnesota is rather unique, a handful of states that have a renter's credit, and those national software companies have had to sort of tweak their systems in order to speak to the renter's credit in the accounting and data management processes that our members have. And so significant effort would need to be put, effort and funds would need to be put into that to change that. And the other thing with the complexity, moving to a more complex position like in the bill, currently we have a number of our larger members that all the month of January they have at least one or two staff members dedicated to doing the certificate of rent paid and making sure that that process is completed by January 31st, which statute says that has to be provided to the renter. So we do appreciate that Representative Drazkowski has recognized those concerns. And the only comment as far as what the percentage might be, we have traditionally not taken a position on what that percentage might be, whether it is in statute. The only thing that we would have a position on is that there are not be multiple jurisdictions, and if and by that I mean multiple rates throughout the state, a county by county or city by city methodology. Our member companies that operate in multiple jurisdictions that can also add to the complexity of it. So either one uniform or perhaps a metro or greater Minnesota.
Thank you. Members, questions? Seeing none. Mr. Cummins, looks like you've made your way. Did you grab a number at the door?
I did, Mr. Chair. I did. For the record, my name is Paul Cummins, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you tonight, and I won't try and keep you guys any longer. So, Mr. Chair, I wanted to just point out that the renter's credit is one of those programs that really help low-income Minnesotans. And, you know, if we remove the first decile as maybe an anomaly, really the second decile is the decile of the people that pay the highest effective tax rates. Of all Minnesotans. And so these are the type of Minnesotans that would be impacted by the renter's credit program. I wanted to just point out one of the questions that I asked was, and we just have an amazing staff. I know that you have the best staff in all of the House of Representatives, but we have pretty great staff at the Department of Revenue, and one of them brought to me a memo from 1990 when this decision was being made in order to move it over. And I'll just read through the memo. So they sampled about 650 of these types of returns back when it was done based more on what I think Representative Drazkowski is trying to do, of over 14,000 of these landlord rental property tax forms. That they received to get an idea of compliance with the requirement to file the landlord rental property tax. So then they talked about the number of errors here. So the number of landlord rental property tax forms with unit less than 200 per month that had an error in them was about 12%. The number of these forms with an incorrect computation on line 2, now this is taking the monthly rent times 12, that's 2%. There was an error rate of 2%. A computation error within line 3 being wrong, and line 3 deals with the 1991 property tax, or the property taxes for the residential portion of the property. That was a 9% error rate. The calculation on line 4, which is dividing, that was a 9% error rate. I'm sorry, a 12% error rate. There was about 30% that didn't include any sort of statement backing up the amount of property taxes paid, even when the landlord was asked to submit it. And then of the forms that had one or more of the lines not filled in, there was about 2%. So I'm not I know that there would be many complications to have to move back to the system. I think some people think that maybe they're If we move back, then there won't be errors or there won't be complications, or maybe it'll be a better way to match property taxes. And I would just ask us to think that maybe this wouldn't be as accurate. as it maybe is made out to be. I also just, in closing, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that this bill would reduce the amount of relief to low and moderate income Minnesotans, particularly in rural Minnesota. So if you look at the percentages below, we are really talking about benefit cuts or to people in rural Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will end my comments. And as always, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with you and Representative Draskowski and other members of the committee to get to the finish line this year. I don't know what the name of the tax bill is going to be, but we'll figure it out along the way.
I told Chair Davids that I heard Journey on the way in yesterday, and I still heard the Don't Stop Believing song.
Okay, very good.
I let him know that.
I have not stopped believing, Mr. Chair. I do know that Greg, Representative Davids tells me that I can stop. but I have not stopped believing.
Mr. Cummins, and I think for anybody that might listen to our meeting or maybe watching if we are televised, the 17% is the gross amount of their rent that they would claim as a deduction. That's not the amount of the refund. I believe that's correct. And what level of income is this actually phased out in which you no longer earn a refund? Is that on the data here?
The 17% is the amount of rent constituting property taxes. Is that the amount that is deemed to be the amount of rent constituting property taxes? Am I mistaken?
No, I understood that, but I think for some they may believe that that's the amount of a refund, 17% of the rent, and that's just the amount they can claim as a deduction against their income.
Of course, Mr.
And so it doesn't amount to a 17% refund of the rent.
Of course, there are different copays amongst different income types.
And did we answer what income level the renter's credit is kind of lost or phased out? Not everybody who is low income as a renter. There's some pretty expensive rental units around.
Absolutely. I would defer to Ms. Manzi on that question.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the projected maximum income eligible for the renter property tax refund for refunds that will be filed next year and based on rent paid in this year and calendar year 2017 is $60,050. That amount is adjusted each year for inflation by the Department of Revenue, and it will be set this August based on what the CPI is for this August compared to the previous August. I also would note that the 17% of rent paid that's deemed to constitute property tax is not claimed as a deduction against income, but rather it's considered to be the property tax amount that you then use the schedule that's in statute to figure what your refund is. So it doesn't get deducted from anything, but rather it's compared to a threshold percentage of your income for what your income level is. And if your property taxes exceed that threshold, then you are required to pay a percentage of it, and the state will pay a percentage of what is then considered to be excess property taxes as a copayment up to a maximum refund amount. And there are threshold percentages and copay percentages and maximums for the different income levels. And those, you can kind of see them in the bills that Representatives Pryor and Loeffler had. And I can make available to you what the schedule is projected to be for next year. Because when you just look in the statute, you see the schedule that was in effect the last time the legislature modified it without the adjustments that have been made for inflation since that time.
Thank you for that explanation, and I think that's what I was interpreting in my mind, but I didn't phrase it correctly. Is the income level that you mentioned, is that in parity with a single-family homeowner, for example, for income level?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the homestead credit state refund for the same time period, so the ones that will be filed next year in 2018, those will be based on taxes payable in 2018, and those are projected to be available for homeowners with incomes up to $110,820.
Okay, thank you for that. Was anybody from the audience would like to testify that wasn't on the list? Seeing none, closing comments. Chair, we have a member question. Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Draskowski and I had a chance to talk about this and his concerns earlier about how to make this quote fairer or more accurately reflect the actual, you know, tax contribution by property by that particular tenant. And I think there are ways that you could look at it. One of them that I had explored and mentioned to him was having the Department of Revenue do an analysis and actually figure out what it was really, using real-time data now that hopefully we'll have a tax bill this year, and the electronic filing of certificates of rent paid will be part of the information database going to the department. And the department will have actual real property IDs. They're going to have the actual rents paid. As I discussed in presenting my bill, the rental market has been incredibly volatile, not just in the metro area, but in regional centers and places with employment growth that can't find construction to house their workers. And so it's really been whipsawed. I think there's some ways that the department could get us closer to understanding this. Rather than using the American Census data, to actually use real Minnesota data related to the market that's going on. But I think it's also important to step back and, as Ms. Madden pointed out, realize that this is just one of several factors in the calculation, and it really is a proxy to be approximately what's there. If we were to go to a different uniform percentage, I wouldn't want us to have it too low for anyone, because that also punishes those that are in the tight rental markets, whether that's in Roseau or whether that's in a suburb of Hennepin County or wherever. And so I think this one we need to think through carefully. But as I've thought about it, I've thought, you know, you do have three different factors interacting here, and one doesn't over-cancel the other. I think it's really about looking at what is the burden of this property tax payment on people of lower modest income, and how do we recognize that? Because unlike Chair Drazkowski, I really do believe that the property taxes are passed on, and that most landlords, when they get their property tax statement, they say, oh, my God, my property taxes are going up $1,200. Well, that means I divide it by 12, the number of months, and then I divide it by the number of units I have, and that's the rent increase, plus whatever utilities or whatever. And I think that's a more typical business model. I think that the nonprofit providers of rental housing, their tenants don't qualify for this because they don't pay property taxes, so we don't have to worry about that. But I really do think that we need to be thinking about this is a way to recognize these people. And I'll just tell you a surprise discussion I had with a realtor on Realtor Day here. And that person said, you know, we've got all kinds of people who can qualify for the mortgage. They cannot get the down payment. That is the biggest obstacle that she's finding in her business to getting people into home ownership. And she said it's the property tax refund, the renter's credit refund, and the income tax refund. That over 5, 6, 7 years, if they commit to, that's where they get their down payment nowadays. And so she says, I counsel people financially all the time, and I say, you're on the 5-year plan or you're on the 7-year plan. But if you commit to it, you'll get to that down payment yet. And so it was interesting to have a different perspective of these refund programs as a step to home ownership.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler, and I think that was pretty well stated. And I think I would agree with your assessment that when business is assess certain costs, that they do pass it on to the consumer, and it is the consumer that pays for that. Any other comments from members? I'm sorry, Rep. Markford.
So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just 2 points to be made, and as I mentioned yesterday with the other day on local government aid, I do think the formulas and that need to be correct. If it's, you know, they need to be credible if you're going to have faith in a system. So I do agree with Representative Drazkowski on, I do think that the percent of rent that constitutes property tax should be as close to accurate as can be, because I think it lends credibility to a program when it's doing what it's supposed to do. So that's the one point. The second point I have, though, is that, you know, this is going to impact folks. And, you know, what Ms. Madden passed out here, and I quickly looked through it, but 9 counties, all in rural Minnesota, those getting the renter's credit, 50% or more in 9 counties, all in rural, are either senior citizens or people with disabilities. And so if this was to become law, according to the revenue note here, that these folks would be getting about $41,000 or $41 million less than what they're getting under current law, $41 million. And so, and I don't know if there's going to be other places in the budget that's going to make that up. But, you know, we have a $1.65 billion surplus, and I do know that there's going to be folks who are much more well off than these folks who are going to see tax cuts. And I just think that's something for this committee to think about, that, yes, I agree that we should get this rent as close to the property tax, but in a budget surplus, we're going to be impacting these kind of most vulnerable people by $41.4 million over current law. And so I don't know if this is going to be made. I know, you know, I'd like to see a Social Security cut, and I think that, you know, very well could be a proposal. But that doesn't hit a lot of these folks in this income group. It would not hit a lot of these seniors. So where are we going to make this up for seniors and folks with disabilities, other places in the budget? So I guess, Chair Druskowski, that would be my main concern here, is that kind of in a time of plenty, if you will, in a surplus, that, you know, folks would be getting less under current law when we're, in fact, going to be giving tax cuts to folks better off than these folks. And so that's my, no question on that, but just, I think, something for the committee to think about.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. So, the closing comments. Chair Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A good discussion, very good topics, and very good points made by all. I look forward to discussion as we go forward. I really think we need to look at and consider a renter's credit system that is accurate and that doesn't figure their property tax burden at an inflated rate, especially when you compare that to the people who own homes. I mean, we're accurate on those when they own the home, but we're actually subsidizing beyond the amount paid in rent for those that rent. So that's the impetus behind the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. So with that, Chair Druskowski renews his motion to hold over House File 2186 for possible inclusion. Next, we have House File 2072. Chair Druskowski has an informational hearing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is not before us. It's still in the possession of the Government Operations Committee, which has heard the bill, but we don't have it before us. So this particular program is the Political Contribution Refund Program. The bill repeals the program. It's about $10 million per biennium. I think, as members know, currently it is not funded in this biennium, but if the legislature and the governor don't make any changes to law, it will click back on July 1st of this year. So this is an effort, without getting too much into the details here, to repeal that program. That's what it does, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, any questions about PCR? Is this something you would want to offer a constitutional amendment to appoint a legislative commission? Excuse me. Couldn't resist. Any members from the audience? Hearing none, then I guess concluding remarks. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler. I didn't see your hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just have to speak in opposition to this. I think it has been a way of strengthening democracy, and it's been, well, at least in my district, well supported by the people who like the idea that they can have a voice even if they can't afford to make much of a contribution, especially after court rulings have said that political donations are free speech, and so it's unlimited for corporate contributions. And I'm kind of surprised that your party would recommend this, because actually when it was in effect, your party collected much more under this than the Democrats. You had an effective way to approach people about this. And
it was a bipartisan effort.
But I do think it's important to think about How do we encourage people to control the cost of complaints, to limit the amount of money they take from special interests and lobbyists? And for a candidate to qualify for this, they had to agree to strict expenditure limits, reporting all that to the state and publicly having it disclosed, and to limit the total amount of money that they took from PACs, lobbyists, and other and large donors. And I think that gave the public a lot more confidence that people could understand who was funding the campaigns. They could look it up on the computer. They could see if you were running on lots of small campaigns or mostly dependent on which special interests. And I think it actually strengthened democracy, and I don't think we do enough of that. She's since deceased, but the most cherished donations I ever got were from a retired woman who would periodically send me a check for $5. And then she would send me her last check in the fall with a note saying, send me the refund form now. And she would gather up her five or six refund receipts, and she said, this is my Christmas club. And she says, when I have a little extra money, I send it to you, and then I get it back, and that's what I use to pay for my Christmas dinner for my family, because she was living in a senior high-rise, very low income. And she says, it's still a point of pride to me that I can go out and buy the fancy fixings that my family has always expected me to provide. And so I just cherished every single one of those checks, and I made sure I told that story to her family when she passed away. And that's what I thought was charming about this program, is it really did allow people to participate in a meaningful way, even if they were the lowest income. And we know those that can write the big checks have found all kinds of ways to contribute in other ways. So I really do hope that we'll reestablish this.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. It sounds like there is a Santa Claus in your district. Anyone else? Closing comments, Chair Gaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the discussion on the bill that we do not have before us.
Thank you with that. And with that, I believe our meeting is adjourned.